Good evening, everyone. Welcome to National Liberty Alliance's weekly conference call. Today is Monday, November 4th, 2019. How am I coming across, Terry or Jan? Coming in clear?
Yep, hopefully. Sounds good to me.
Great. Yep. Not too loud. Not.
Nope.
Okay. All right. We broadcast live every Monday from 9 p.m. Eastern till midnight. If you are listening live over our radio or another network and you would like to ask a question or make a comment, you can go to nationallibertyalliance.org and click on our weekly call for instructions to join us by phone, app, or browser. If anyone would like to email a question, you can send your questions, that's plural questions, at nationallibertyalliance.org. Also, please support our business partners. You can find their banners on the right-hand side of our website, of which the proceeds go to support NLA's effort to save America. Also, please support NLA by donating $5 a month or more. Click on our donation tab on the top right-hand side of our website. Okay, before we get started, we're going to have some scripture reading. We're going to pick up where we left off last week. We're in the Gospel of Mark. All right, we'll be reading the Gospel of Mark, chapter 6, verses 30 through 44. And the apostles gathered themselves together unto Jesus and told him all things, both what they had done and what they had taught. And he said unto them, Come ye yourselves apart into a desert place and rest a while. For there were many coming and going, and they had no leisure so much as to eat. And they departed into a desert place by ship privately. And the people saw them departing, and many knew him, and ran afoot thither out of all cities, and out went them, and came together unto him. And Jesus, when he came out, saw much people, and was moved with compassion towards them, because they were as sheep, not having a shepherd. And he began to teach them many things. And when the day was now far spent, his disciples came unto him, and said, This is a desert place, and now the time is far past. Send them away, that they may go into the country round about, and into the villages, and buy themselves bread, for they have nothing to eat. He answered and said unto them, Give ye them to eat. And they say unto him, Shall we go and buy 200 pennies worth of bread, and give them to eat? He saith unto them, How many loaves have ye? Go and see. And when they knew, they say, 5 and 2 fishes. And he commanded them to make all sit down by companies upon the green grass. And they sat down in ranks by hundreds and by fifties. And when he had taken the 5 loaves and the 2 fish, he looked up into heaven and blessed and brake the loaves and gave them to his disciples and set before them. And the 2 fishes divided he among them all. And they did all eat and were filled. And they took up 12 baskets full of all fragments and of all fishes. And they that did eat of the loaves were about 5,000 men. That was the Gospel of Mark, chapter 6, verses 30 through 44. Okay, tonight's focus is going to be on the rules of common law. You know, I've had people ask where you can find a copy of the rules of common law. And you can kind of find a list of different maxims, because common law is all about maxims. It's self-evident truth. It's truth that cannot be denied. And that's how a court runs, at least a natural law court runs. Inopposed to be driven by statutes and certain governmental requirements and punishments and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, going through rules, statutes, regulations. None of this applies to the people. What applies to us is the law of the heart. You know, the key thing that one could say to really describe what a crime might be is, or how to prevent a crime, is do no harm. If you harm someone, then you've injured someone. You owe to that person that you restore that person. It may not be a criminal act, but nevertheless, you're still liable and responsible for restoring that individual that you injured. And so common law is driven by truth. self-evident truth. One of the key things, of course, is the tribunal, and the tribunal is made up of 12 people, and those 12 individuals, witness, the courtroom drama, for lack of another word, where people come in to bear witness, the documents being brought, people making their statements and on what took place, so on and so forth. And truth has a way of rising up out of the conversations. If you listen to an individual long enough, you should be able to discover their motives to some degree. And it's the same thing in a court. If you listen very carefully to all of the evidence and so on, it should rise. And in common law, it requires 12 individuals to agree. If the 12 individuals cannot agree and they come to the realization, we're just never going to agree, then they got to acquit the person. So 12 people have to agree. And, of course, they need to take time to deliberate, to have conversations. You know, some people might think a person is guilty of something and others might think they're not guilty of it. And, of course, through conversation, you start to share your reasoning, and then we start to convince each other. Oh, yeah, I forgot that had happened. Yeah, that doesn't look good, or whatever. And again, that which drives the court, the rules of that court, is driven by self-evident truths. Our Constitution was written and guided by self-evident truths, maxims, if you will. Our Bill of Rights, clearly, self-evident truths, and so on. So we're going to look at that. The subject, like I said tonight, is going to be the rules of common law, and it's going to be a short study, probably about 15 minutes. And I think by the time we come to the end, everybody should have a pretty good grip on how a common law works and what the rules are. It's nothing set down in stone. It's whatever comes up out of the court at the time. Self-evident truths are discovered. Not just recorded. We're going to discover that there are a few places you can go read lists of maxims. And again, we've spoken, mentioned maxims over time. For instance, for every injury, there must be a remedy. Innocent until proven guilty, that's a maxim. No one can argue with that. No one should be held to be guilty until you prove that they're guilty. So everyone is innocent until you prove them guilty. They're perceived innocent, at least. They may not be innocent. But nevertheless, we have, of course, statutes which governs, the equity courts. And equity courts have rules. The rules that have been put together, some of them are pretty bad, by the way. Rule 12 is problematic. We've had problems with that. We've discussed that in the past. Rule 2 clearly is problematic. They tried to combine equity and law and created what they call civil law. Not like that's some discovery, because civil law has been around for thousands and thousands of years. It goes way, way back to Babylon, where civil law really found its first place. It's the law of the city. It's the law to control the people of a city. And just because we might be called a citizen, that doesn't put us under civil law. It puts us under civil responsibilities, but not civil law. This is where their law comes from. And they've changed our Constitution. Well, they've actually nullified our Constitution is what they've done. We need to make that clearer and clearer and clearer, because people should be really upset about that. And this is really the message, that they have totally destroyed our Constitution. People who have not been in courts, they may not know that they have no unalienable rights. When you get into a court, especially if you're going up against the government, or the government's going up against you, or you're going up against the corporations, or the corporation is going up against you, you're going to discover real quick you have no rights. Court's going to trample all over you. There is no justice. There is no law. It's chaos. And is ruled by tyrant. So anybody who's had experience in courts knows this. Those people who don't, and most people, a lot of people have not had the experiences, so they have no clue how serious it is. they still think that they have unalienable rights. They think they're protected by the Constitution. And of course we should be, but we're not. But with what we're doing, we're putting the pressure on the courts, particularly the United States Supreme Court, pressure on both houses. I think they're too dumb to realize we're putting pressure on them, but they're going to find out sooner or later by the wrath of the people at some point in time. They're making a real mockery of our republic, calling it a democracy, creating chaos and problems, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And it's going to be a matter of time. They're going to have a rude awakening. The people. Well, again, that's all, of course, if the people step up and do the right thing, and that is to take the controls, to control our courts, to control our political process. And last week we spoke somewhat about the committee man. And, you know, I know we have listed tonight as a night to speak about the committee man, but we're not going to focus in on that. But we will take questions on that. We were talking about the committee man last week. This week we're going to talk about, again, the rules of common law. So any of those subjects, you know, is really where we should try to stick in our conversations and discussions, questions, and so on. Try to stick in those areas as much as we can. But we can come out. We have a broad scope of subject matter that we can discuss. But as we go on, we're going to be touching different subjects. And we should try to do what we can to keep our conversations on those subjects or the subjects past. But again, we can go outside those guidelines. We don't have to stick that strictly to those guidelines. Becoming a committee man, Jan, we need to find a volunteer, maybe Ruth or someone you can give this job to. We need to go out and collect all of the election laws of every state. Just this evening before the program started, I kind of just threw in, you know, I threw in Jersey. I just put NJ election law PDF. And voila, very quickly, I got a copy of the PDF of election law. So all I had to do is just save that copy and collect them. We need to collect all, let's say, 49 states, because we have New York already. I didn't download New Jersey, so we still need New Jersey. But we need someone to do that and to really focus in and stay focused until they get through that. Then we're going to put a small committee together to work on that, all those election laws, to discover how they work their designating petitions in that state, when they're filed, and so on and so forth. So we need to gather that information, because that's the information we got to give to people. We're going to do a one of these Mondays, maybe coming up in the next sometime this later this month possibly. We're going to do a sort of a study or a focus on how to fill out a designating petition to become a committee man. And so last week we talked about what a committee man is, what they do, the powers and the authorities, and actually we went beyond that because we really were focusing in on NLA's plan in a nutshell. Now, I did post last week's paper, which was on the front page, and this week's paper has also been posted, and you can find that up on our website, nationallibertyalliance.org. And if you go to education, highlight education, come down to weekly topics. That's a new tab. We just put that up a couple of days ago. Right now, there's two papers in there. One is the plan to save the republic. It's got a date, and that date, of course, refers back to last week when we did this particular subject. And so people can go back and listen to that and read through this, or just read the paper. And these are the things we need to really digest and come to an understanding of. Tonight, again, we're going to be discussing the rules of common law courts, particularly the rules of the common law courts. And again, next week we'll have another subject and so on. But again, we're going to get to the petitions. Now, we set up a page for anybody who wants to become a committee man. As I mentioned, everyone should become a committee man at least once in their lifetime. Okay, maybe we can shut videos off. No videos. Let me see if I can. I don't know how to control that. Stop all videos. I guess that's it. Okay, no video sharing, at least not at this point. maybe when we get into open forum, if people want to turn their videos on, we'll have to figure out how to. I don't know how to turn it on. I don't know if you know how to do that, Jan or Terry. I just hit to stop all videos, but we can turn them back on when we come to, if we can figure that out, when we come to our open forum. But anyway, getting back to the subject at hand, what we're speaking about. So all these subjects we're going to be posting up here as we go forward. Now, petitions have to be written up in a very particular way, and you can't afford to make a mistake on these petitions, not one. If you do, you can get cast out, and believe me, there'll be people trying to cast you out. But nevertheless, they need to be filed correctly and in a proper timing. The workload of a committee man, every person should at least once in their lifetime become a committee man. I'd like to ask everybody to become a committee man now for this first, especially the people, the members that have been coming and listening to our programming and learning and studying, whether they're coming live to listen or maybe they're listening through the podcasts at a later time throughout the week. But everybody should sign up to become a committee man. It's a very rewarding position. It's not a paid position. It requires approximately 40 hours a year, so it's not a lot of time. It's always in the evening, usually 2 or 3 hours here or there. Your meetings are very rare. You know, in the beginning, you know, you really just structure a little bit of a structure. You might have a meeting on a structure, which we'll discuss these type of meetings at a later date when we need to start to teach people about how to run meetings. But really, it's not very complicated. The first meeting might be just structuring and organizing, okay? And then the rest of the meetings pretty much should be really interviewing potential statesmen, people who are running for office. We want to interview them, discover whether we want to support them, and if we decide to support them, then we vote in blocks, and then we carry their petitions for signature. Of course, we want to put as many people as we can onto the primary ballots, let the people actually have a good a group of people to decide from who they'd like to represent them and for their vote in the primary, and then of course you will have the general elections. The big problem in America, and anybody who's watching anything that's going on anywhere, whether it's the fake news or even places where you can get good sources of news, if you're out there listening and watching what's going on, these people are totally destroying our republic, destroying it. Unless the people start to become educated to be able to recapture and, reset our republic, and that's the job of the committee man to begin with, and also the job of the administrators for the juries. And the administrators for the juries, as everyone should know at this point, is a paid position. It's a career position, and both jobs are very rewarding. Now, if you become if you're becoming an administrator, you can also become a committee man at the same time. There is no conflict of interest because you're not politically motivated, you're not hired by the government, you're working for the people, and of course the people who are going to become administrators will be the most educated, and therefore the ideal people to train and teach people that are committee men the things that they should know and understand. But anyway, this 40 hours a week, roughly speaking, is just a couple hours here and a couple hours there. And in many cases, especially the odd years, a lot less. Maybe you work 20 hours a year, It's not a lot. But you're the people. The job is all about sponsoring people or working the petitions for people that you want to put on the ballot. To question them. Are they good statesmen? Do they know the Constitution? Tell me about the Second Amendment. Tell me about the First Amendment. Tell me what about the Tenth Amendment? Ask these people questions. What is your job criteria? Are you running for a Senate? Or are you running for a House representative? Or are you running for mayor? What's your job, requirements? What is your jurisdiction? What is your authorities? These people need to know these things. And we will be teaching all of these things. And you don't really have to remember all of the details. We're going to have you know, books, handbooks, and of course we're creating a book for the administrators. We'll probably create a book for committeemen also, which will give a lot of instructions and ideas and different things. The book that could grow over time also, we can always be adding new things, but so that we can really operate the way we should be operating. Our founding fathers used the committeeman process through the committees of safety. Okay, and it was the committees of safety. Every single one of our founding fathers, everyone that was part of the birth of America, and let me say that again, everybody that was part of the birth of America was part of the committees of safety. That was the structure and the process by they used in order to create this nation, to bring this nation to where it is. And when George Washington was elected president and the Constitution came into effect, then the committees of safety morphed into the committeemen. And now the committeeman's job is really to make sure we keep our republic, because we've about lost it. And now if you take what's going on today with all this political stuff, the politicking, all that's got to go. And if we actually require these people to understand their oath, and bear in mind, they do not understand their oath, and neither do the, and there's no elected committeemen today anyway. We're going to show people how to become the first elected committeemen in quite some time. Goodness, they've probably been dead 30, 40 years, maybe even longer. There has not been an elected committeeman. But in any event, you know, we're going to train people on how to go through that process. But if the committeeman does not know the Constitution, if the committeeman doesn't know what the authorities of Congress might be under Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution, if the committeeman doesn't understand their unalienable rights, particularly the 10 that we defined in the Bill of Rights, if the committeeman doesn't know what a maxim is, if the committeeman doesn't understand the authorities and the jurisdictions of the courts, and that there are only two jurisdictions, law and equity, and that civil law is an abomination to our republic, if the committeeman doesn't know those things, how can they know if the individual that they are choosing to put onto the ballot knows those things? Because those are the questions we need to be asking. And if they don't know the answers, we can send them to National Liberty Alliance, take the course, bone up on it, and come back, and we'll ask you questions again. The committeeman can recall anybody who is of bad behavior. We can pull anyone out of office within 90 days just by doing a recall. 90 days out of office, new person in. Of course, they also could be removed by indictment if they've committed a crime. But it is the committeeman that holds the lamp of liberty. And so, you know, we really need to be thinking about this. So anyway, anybody who wants to become a committeeman, and I hope a lot of people sign up tonight, go out to our website, nationallibertyalliance.org, highlight the grand jury, click on Become a Committeeman, and you can then come and read that page. At the bottom of the page, it says, you know, you must be signed up for the government by consent course to fill out this form. But then you click on the form at the bottom. Click here to fill out the form to run for committeeman. Make sure you're signed in, otherwise you won't get to that page. You also have to be signed up for the course, otherwise you won't get to that page. So anyway, you get to the committeeman form. There's very minimum questions. They're just your state, your county, whether you're Republican or Democrat. You need your nine-digit zip code, and if you can't find your nine-digit zip code, we do have information on how to find it. I'm looking right now. I don't see it on the page, so I'll have to, after tonight's program, maybe tomorrow morning I'll put it up there, or tonight I'll try to get up there and put it up there. But there is a way to find that nine-digit zip code. That nine-digit zip code identifies your election district, and with that nine-digit zip code, you're able to identify, you know, every office that anybody is running for office for that particular election that affects your election district, that you would be able to see that information. But anyway, the information on this page, which will consist of, when you sign up, there'll be a page where it'll show up the person's state, county, election district, party affiliation, and their phone number. But nobody will be able to see that page except for other committeemen. And the purpose for that, of course, is when you go in there and you look to see your name up or your county, your state, you'll see other people in your county, and you definitely want to connect with people in your county. And definitely, if other people in your election district, you want to make sure, well, election district's close by to your in your county, you know, you definitely want to make sure you're not running in an election district where someone else is running. Because you can run in any election district within your city or town. I have to think about the city part. I have to explore that a little more because cities are quite big and, you know, they're a little more, they're also divided in another way other than the county because it's so big. But definitely in a town, if you're any town you live in, you can run in any election district. You want to run the election district you live in if possible, or maybe instead of the people on the streets to your right, you know, the next election district to the streets to your left might be available. So you run there. So we don't want to run against each other is our point. There's lots of committeemen already in place that have been appointed. And these people, you know, a lot of these people have, you know, trying to do the right thing. And they think they're voting for people. You know, they're being bamboozled, just like all of us are anyway. But they're being kind of bamboozled to believe that their voting counts, and it really doesn't. The whole thing's a fix. It's been a fix for a long time. But we can train those people. When we come into power and authority, we can get rid of all the party bosses. They're not going to want to be around us because we're going to be bringing in, you know, a proper process where you're not going to make money in the position. A lot of people make money in this position, you know. You become a county chairman, you get involved in some big things, get contracts if you own a garage or if you're a contractor or a certain whatever. You know, you get to get into the business side of things and favors take place, and that's all unlawful. And so we're going to cut all that out. So they're not going to want to be there, and so they'll disappear. But the people who remain, which will be quite a few people, we can train them. We can teach them. What you learn will require them to go to a course, take our course, Government by Consent, and a civics course. And if they would take that course, then we'll teach them how to become an elected committeeman. But you know what? On the one hand, you don't want to say, well, you can't do it because if you don't do this, you can't do that. On the one hand, that's true. But on the other hand, look at these people. Should be holding these positions if they don't understand those positions. Again, how do you understand the positions? You understand the Constitution. So by taking a good course in the Constitution and understand the basics, you will be qualified to ask the proper questions and get the proper people in office that will represent the people and do the right thing. And we'll get rid of this politics because politics will no longer be needed. You know, politics is all about one group getting an edge over the other group, okay? And it's party mob is what it is. They come together, you take the party line, you got to be the party mob. That's what's destroying us. And the party mob is all ruled by who? Special interest groups. That's where all the money comes from. They're not voting your interest when they go to Washington. They're voting their own interest. The interest that's going to give them money, power, and authority and maintain their place forever as a senator. You know, these people make career senators. We were never set up for that. That's not what our republic is about. Nobody should be doing any more than two back-to-back fillings of an office. So if you're a senator, and by the way, you know, U.S. senators should not be voted in by the people. What was it? The 17th Amendment destroyed that. And that's null and void. It's repugnant to the Constitution. It destroys the structure of power, and it destroys takes away the authority of the state, and it removes the sovereignty of the state. The states are no longer sovereign because they don't have that process. Hold on 1 minute. Sorry. So anyway, the states are no longer sovereign. They have no control over their senators. But anyway, getting back on track here. People need to understand the basics. So if you're going to be a committee man and you're going to raise your hand and say, I swear to uphold and support the Constitution, well, if you don't know it, how can you swear to uphold and support it? Obviously, you can't. So we need to know this. Our children need to know this. And we have a plan to get into the schools and get a serious education concerning these things, civics and consent of government to our children. So anyway, tonight we're going to be focusing in, as I said, on the courts. But again, anybody wants to sign up for a committee man, get out there and sign up. Well, you're not going to be able to sign up till tomorrow because I'm looking. There's no information on how to get your 9-digit zip. All you need to know is your 5-digit zip code and your actual address, and we'll give a page where you can go. The U.S. Post Office has a page where you can go to, and you put that information in, and they give you a 9-digit zip code. And that 9-digit zip code, like I said, identifies your election district. And you need that 9-digit zip in order to sign up. But I'll get that on tonight. Okay, so subject focus is going to be the rules of the common law. And we'll have some discussions, hopefully, about that after this. Rules of the Common Law Courts, the light of liberty's lamp. Where rights secured by the Constitution are involved, there can be no rulemaking or legislation which would abrogate them. Miranda versus Arizona. The Rules Enabling Act, passed by Congress in 1934, gave the Supreme Court the power to make rules of procedure and evidence for federal courts in equity, as long as they did not abridge, enlarge, or modify any substantive right. The Supreme Court needs to be reminded that the rules are not law. They are just rules with no authority to group together suits in equity and suits of common law under the term of civil law, also known as Babylonian law. Congress doesn't even possess such authority. We the people, via the Constitution, ordained only law and equity under Article 3, Section 1, and Sections 2, where we read, "The judicial powers of the United States shall be vested in one Supreme Court, and in such inferior courts as the Congress may from time to time ordain and establish. The judges of both the Supreme and the inferior courts shall hold their office during good behavior. The judicial power shall be extended to all cases in law and equity arising under this Constitution, the laws of the United States, and the treaties made of which shall be made under their authority." We did not give Congress or the judiciary power to legislate or enforce civil and criminal statutes which are disguised as law and written by tyrants to conceal the common law and oppress the people. They have been deluded into believing we are their subjects. All judges are bound by their oath to the supreme law of the land, also known as the United States Constitution, under Article 6, Clause 2, where we read, "This Constitution and the laws of the United States, which shall be made in pursuant thereof, and all treaties made or which shall be made under the authority of the United States, shall be the supreme law of the land, and the judges in every state shall be bound thereby. Anything in the Constitution or the laws of any state to the contrary notwithstanding, any judge who does not comply with his oath to the Constitution of the United States wars against that Constitution and engages in acts in violation of the supreme law of the land. The judge is engaged in acts of treason. Rules are an established standard guide or regulation, a principle or regulation set up by authority, prescribing by or directing action or restraint. If you are in an equity court, then the federal rules of civil procedure apply to that jurisdiction. If you are in a court of law, then the rules of common law applies. Common law, as distinguished from equity law, it is a body of rules and principles, written or unwritten, which are of fixed and immutable authority, and which must be applied to controversies rigorously and in their entirety, and cannot be modified to suit the particularities of a specific case or colored by any judicial discretion, and which rest confessedly upon custom or statutes as distinguished from any claim to ethical superiority. Common law eludes definition because it is not a list of laws. It is not built upon precedents or a collection of equity court rulings. Common law is written into our hearts and our minds, being naturally common unto all men. For even the godless, having not the law, do by nature the things contained in the law, showing the works of the law written in their hearts, their conscience also bearing witness. Common law is the laws of nature and of nature's God that proceed upon two self-evident truths called maxims. One, for every injury there must be a remedy. And two, in order for there to be a crime, there must be an injured party, without which no court may proceed. Maxims are brief statements of self-evident truths that control our common law courts. They provide discernment in the writing of our founding documents. It is an advisor to our legislators and every consideration of mankind that seeks what's fair and best for all. Courts that do not honor or consider these maxims are not just. Indeed, whether and to what extent these common law maxims are honored by public leaders is how we test the way they administer the law to govern. Our courts were established to enforce these principles of common law. The word justice is synonymous with virtue, and virtue is a biblical principle that emanates from Jesus Christ alone. Maxims are the laws that never change. These statements set essential limits on truth and are essential to the fair and efficient administrations of justice according to the common law of mankind. No right-thinking person can disagree with a maxim. Every court is bound by the common law rules of equity established by never-changing maxims. Maxims test those who judge and put an absolute limit on those who rule. Maxims and precepts are the rules of common law. Maxims are self-evident truths used to adjudicate common law cases. Axioms, also known as sayings. In logic, are self-evident indisputable truths, the results of human reason and experience. Maxims are our common law heritage and bind us together as a people. If everyone knew the maxims of common law, our world would be a far better place. The following is a short list of maxims, again also known as self-evident truths. Maxims on principles of common law. All men are created equal. Men are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights. Liberty to all, but preference to none. The safety of people is the supreme law. The safety of the people cannot be judged but by the safety of every individual. To lie is to go against the mind. The only one who has any capacity or right or responsibility or knowledge to rebut your affidavit of truth is the one who is adversely affected by it. It's his job, his right, his responsibility to speak for himself. No one else can know what your truth is or has the free will responsibility to state it. This is your job. Each of us is entitled to equal treatment under law. The workman is worthy of his hire. Nothing ventured, nothing gained. Maxims on the legitimacy of government. Just governments derive their just powers from the consent of the governed. Unjust is state powers, where the law is either uncertain or unknown. The state should be subject to the law, for the law creates the state. The judge who decides a case without hearing both parties, though his decision be just, is himself unjust. Courts of justice are for the common people to command the power of the state. Maxims on testimony and evidence. Words should be considered only as commonly understood and not with the meanings others construed to their own purpose. No one should be believed in court except upon his oath. Courts should not believe water runs upward on its own accord, nor that impossibilities exist. The certainty of a thing in court arises only from making the thing certain in court. Maxims on civil duties or of citizens. Whenever any form of government becomes destructive, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it, and to institute new government. Each should use his own power and property so as not to unjustly injure another. Maxims on the civic duties of citizens. Whenever any form of government becomes destructive, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it, and to institute new government. Each should use his own powers and property so as not to unjustly injure another. Maxims on private property. There is nothing more sacred, more violate, than the house of every citizen. Every home is a castle. Though the winds of heaven blow through it, officers of the state cannot enter. Title is the right to enjoy possessions of that which is our own. Maxims on unalienable rights. The Bill of Rights is a list of self-evident truths. None has a greater claim to live free. No one should be required to betray himself, i.e., no one should be made to testify against himself. The right of the people to keep and bear arms is necessary for the security of a free state. Everyone should be presumed innocent until his guilt is established beyond a reasonable doubt. Liberty to all, but preference to none. None is entitled to any privilege denied to others. Absolutely none. It is against justice for freemen not to have the free disposal of their own property. No king, no priest, no celebrity, no judge, not any person has any greater right to walk free than any lowly carpenter, plumber, or law-abiding street minstrel. Maxims on judicial reasonings. The burden of proof lies on him who asserts the facts, not on him who denies it, because from the very nature of things, a negative cannot be proved. No one should be twice harassed for the same offense. We are all equal in the sight of our law. Maxims test those who judge. Maxims put an absolute limit on those who rule. He who slices the pie should be last to take a piece. Servant judges cannot judge sovereigns. A thing similar is not exactly the same thing. Innocent until proven guilty. No one is above the law. Words should be construed only as commonly understood and not with the meaning others construed to their own purpose. All are equal under the law. Truth is expressed in the form of an affidavit. An unrebutted affidavit stands as the truth. He who leaves the battlefield first loses by default. Sacrifice is the measure of credibility. A lien or claim can be satisfied only through rebuttal by affidavit, point by point, resolution by jury, or payment. He who bears the burden ought to also derive the benefit. If the plaintiff does not prove his case, the defendant is absolved. No court and no judge can overturn or disregard or abrogate somebody's affidavit of truth. Words should be interpreted most strongly against him who uses them. Maxims on crime and punishment. He who acts in pure defense of his own life or limb is justified. Crimes are more effectually prevented by the certainty than by the severity of punishment. Perjured witnesses should be punished for perjury and for the crimes they falsely accused against others. You can find more information and more maxims at nationallibertyalliance.org/court-forms. You can find maxims of law from Bouvier's 1856 Law Dictionary, The Lawful Path, and Sir Edward Coke's maxims. In conclusion, there are thousands of maxims, and many yet to be discovered. They are simply pure logic and justness clearly seen by any reasonable person. They are self-evident truths. Maxims are only denied by the lawless and tyrants. Okay. So again, maxims is the key. Those are the rules of the common law. And it makes sense, of course, because really we want to get down to the truth of the matter. And you will find these maxims, these truths, these self-evident truths. You'll find consistency in, for instance, in the witnesses, whether witnessing for yourself or someone else witnessing for you or within the documents. If there's any inconsistency there, then, of course, you know, there's a problem. Someone's lying. Someone's not being truthful. But again, you know, look, maxims are very clear. When it's heard, it's heard. You know, we the people have the right to have government by consent. That's a maxim. All governments in this world, from the beginning of time to present, is ruled by men, except for those governments ruled by law. And when I say ruled by law, I mean by natural law. And that natural law is what gives us our Constitution, which again is ultimately maxims. It's the most logical thing. It's the most obvious thing. To keep us free, to protect our liberties, bring forth the truth. We don't need regulations. We don't need government to tell us that murder is wrong. We already know that. We don't need government to tell us that, stealing is wrong. And every case is different. No two cases are ever the same. They may be similar. But a maxim is a thing similar is not necessarily the same thing. That's a maxim, by the way. I don't know who founded that one, but the maxim, the books of maxims that we had written, that we mentioned here, there's maxims of law from Bouvier's. I don't think Bouvier ultimately wrote those maxims himself. Maybe he did some, but it's a collection of maxims that he has discovered and heard and collected. Sir Edward Coke's maxims, again, a collection of maxims. And I know in my study of law here, in my writings from time to time, I find myself that I'm writing maxims. It's self-evident truth from the evidence of whatever it is that you're studying, particularly in law or political process or judicial process, you know. Obviously, Rule 12 is repugnant. Even the United States Supreme Court has ruled it as being repugnant. They said that it's not necessary to throw someone out on Rule 12. The case itself will bear itself up or it won't, period. End of subject. That's a maxim, too. It'll hold its own weight. If obviously there is no case there, it'll be seen. Okay? It'll be founded. There's no reason why it shouldn't go forward. Okay, so Rule 12 is repugnant. Repugnant in even in equity, and more so in common law. And remember, our equity courts are courts of common law also, okay? An equity court, you know, just because a government has a constitution, Russia, okay, has a constitution. but it was written by the state. Okay, so when they go out and make what they call equity or civil, you know, laws for to control government, which what we call equity, that's not equity for them. That's just more civil law and control. You know, equity law is a law that sits underneath common law. It's a lawful process of law. And how do you know if something is a lawful process of law? Well, you trace back its source. It must be traced back to God. So where do these people in Congress get the authority to write statutes and regulations and codes? Where do they get that authority? Well, they get it from the people. They get it from the Constitution, particularly in Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution, where we've listed out 18 powers of Congress to write law. And that's where they received it. But we've got to trace that back to God. Where did that Constitution come to that authority? It came from the people. We, the people, ordained and established this Constitution for the United States of America. So government is underneath the Constitution. We are raised above the Constitution. They can make no law to guide us, to govern us, to control us, to subject us. The 14th Amendment makes a claim that if you're a U.S. citizen, you are subject to the laws therein. I am not subject to the laws of the United States. They have nothing to do with me. The laws of the United States is for the sole purpose to rule whatever it is that we gave them the authority, whether it's commercial activity, where we gave them certain authorities, maybe writing rules and laws for bankruptcies, and of course for controlling each one of these different government agencies. They need to have regulations, laws, rules, and statutes. They need to have guidelines. Okay, we the people don't need that. We have our hearts. That's what we have. That's our guideline. We guideline through our hearts. God said He wrote it into the hearts we know the law. Even the unbeliever knows the law. Even a serial killer knows he's doing wrong when he kills. They know. Okay, God said He wrote it into the hearts of men. We know, thou shalt not injure another. That's the prime directive. Do not injure another. Period. End of subject. If you don't injure anybody, you can't be liable for breaking any law. For every injury, there must be a remedy. Again, another maxim. Two of the major maxims that guide our courts. You know, for every injury, there must be a remedy. In order for there to be a crime, there must be an injured party. You know, without an affidavit, a court case can't go forward. You take all these IRS cases, remember that. If you're in the IRS, there's a battle, okay? If there is no sworn affidavit concerning the charges against you, they have no case, nothing to be opened, okay? And that's true with any court. When you go into the town courts, there's no affidavits there. You might say, well, I got a ticket and the cop signed it. Well, that's not an affidavit. They might even have a special form. I swear this, that, and the other thing. Officer, you know, Grumpke here, blah, 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 and he signs it. That doesn't mean anything. That's not a sworn affidavit. Sworn affidavit has to be sworn before a magistrate or before a notary or even before a judge and other individuals that hold those powers and authorities. Again, you know, these are the things that are needed. And going back to committeemen, we need to understand these things just as much as the administrators need to understand these things. But I'll tell you what, every American needs to understand these things. We need to re-educate our children. I'm not going to go down that road tonight, but we've spoke about that before. We'll speak about it again in the future. We have to educate ourselves first and educate as many people around us as we can. Otherwise, we're not going to be able to save America. You know, I've mentioned this maybe once or twice in the past. I'm going to mention it again. You know, when we start our program every Monday evening, one of the things I say is that please support our business partners. You can find their banners on the right-hand side of our website, which the proceeds go to support NLA's effort to save America. There is nobody, no group, no organization, no individual that is exercising a plan to save America. Let me repeat that. There is nobody, no group, no organization, no individual that is representing and pushing forward a plan to save America. Now, it may be true that this is what Trump is doing. He can only bring America to a point, but the people have to step up and take control. And if they don't do it, America has been lost. It has not been saved. We're at the brink. We're at the edge of the cliff. We're about ready to lose it all. Even with all the work that Trump is doing and all the patriots are doing, if the people don't step up and fill the void, the power structure void that is about to break loose, as soon as the deep state is done and out of there, someone's got to control all that power because they're controlling it right now. Who's going to control that power? We're going to let these congressmen and unlawfully elected senators control that? We're going to let some president control that? We're going to let some judge, some court control that? Well, then we've sold ourselves out. We're no longer a free people. We don't have liberty. We deserve to lose our unalienable rights. Few people have found that in this world. Only two nations in the history of mankind has found that form of government. Only two. One is Israel, and the other is the United States. And we are about to lose it. So again, everybody, think very hard about becoming a committee man this term around. Take power. It's a two-year position, a two-year period, you know, position for 2 years. And again, you only work around election time, you know. And it's a great job, one of the best jobs out there. What better job is there than to be the person who sits and listens and questions the individual who wants to take a position in power and authority? And what better job is there than to interview those people to see if they understand that they should be bound down by the chains of the Constitution? And of course, also administrators. So, okay, I guess that brings us to the end of that. Before we go into an open forum, a couple of things. Is Brent here? Has anybody seen Brent tonight yet? Maybe someone can keep an eye out for him. We're going to go to him in a short while.
Yeah, I haven't seen him yet.
We have two people that are signed up as National Liberty Alliance. I don't know if Brent's one of them or not.
Okay, listen, everybody that's come in to sign in, when you go to your sign-in thing, you can put your own email there. You don't have to put the NLA's email there. Put your own email there, you know, Janet at National Liberty Alliance, Terry at National Liberty Alliance, or whatever. And it'll take that, okay, because you're already signed in to join this as a host automatically anyway. But changing that to your email address will fix that problem, and then we'll know who it is. That's it. Of course, you put your own name there instead of National Liberty Alliance or instead of my name, which pops up. You know, put your own name. It'll work itself out. But anyway, we'll keep an eye out for Brent. First, we want to go through any announcements and if there's any questions. So what do you got, Jan?
Yes, I'm happy to announce.
Before you do that, I don't want to forget this. I'm sorry. I did go up there, and I was able to put in on the page for Committee Man a link, okay, to where you go to get your 9-digit zip code. So people can sign in tonight. You can sign in while our program is running. You can sign in after the program. You can sign in first thing in the morning. You can sign in anytime you want. So sign up to become a Committee Man. I know we haven't set this up this way yet. I'm going to talk with Carl and make sure we could do this. But I did write up here. Let me just read what I wrote, okay? You will need your 9-digit zip code to sign up for Committee Man in your election district. If the form below rejects your 9-digit zip code, and this is what I'm not sure whether we could do. I think we can, and Carl, if you're listening, if we could do that, maybe you could do that when you get a chance. It's not an emergency, but when you get a chance. But anyway, it goes on. If the form rejects your 9-digit zip code, it is because someone has already signed up to run for committeeman in your election district. I got right now to contact Jan. We may put someone else there eventually, but right now, call Jan, and I get his phone number there for assistance to help you find an election district in your town near your home. So it may be the streets to the right of your house, and the next election district may be the streets to the left of your house. You know, it's going to be that close. So again, as long as you're running within your town, that's the key. All the information is up there now to sign up, and everybody please sign up. Jan.
Okay. I am happy to say and announce that we have had 6 people sign up for the Red Pill Expo in Mesquite, Nevada, starting Friday of this week and running Friday and Saturday. That means we have a free table there to advertise, and Brent Winters and NLA have a joint table, so we'll be putting up information for both of us. If you have anything that you think would be important to add, just send it to me, email at jan@nationallibertyalliance.org, and we'll take a look at it. I know this is a short fuse, but we kind of got down to the wire here before we got all 6 people. So we're in the process, too, of John's going to take a look tomorrow, I hope, and see if we can't get a group of things put together, and we'll get them out to the people that are going to man the tables. This is going to be a fun expo. Now, this is at least the second, if not the third, expo for this year. They had one in Hartford, Connecticut, probably 6 months ago. I think if we keep track of where the next one comes, and these are going to be apparently regularly scheduled, we should try and attend each and every one. It's a great way and a great place to have a table and give us the opportunity to speak with like-minded people. So keep that in mind. It'll involve a little travel, maybe. I know for Dan, he lives in Montana. He's going down to Las Vegas area with a friend. And I know Brent's Indiana. He's got a long haul to get out there, too. But, you know, if you have a little time and are so inclined, it's a great expo. They've all had really great speakers. And, you know, save up a little cash and get yourself a ticket or drive and try and hit the next one we come up with. That's other than the fact that we're running short again on people to help with the welcome committee calling. That seems to be pretty much a continuous request. We really could use some help there. We'd appreciate anybody who has some time and inclination and wants to do a little training, and they will tell you exactly what you need to do, so you don't have to worry about, I don't know much about this, I'm a newbie, this sort of thing. They'll take care of training you, and they'll be happy to have you there to help out. So those are really the 2 things I wanted to cover tonight. I do have 4 or 5 questions, John, if you're ready for questions. John?
I'm sorry, I was muted.
Oh, I was going to say, maybe I lost again.
We're also looking for a paralegal, someone who can volunteer their time, someone who has some experience, at least in maybe reading some law. Nothing really crazy, but, you know, in this case, it's election law. And we know all the key words. You know, if we pull down the election law in a particular state, let's say, because we've studied inside and outside, upside down and right side up election law here in New York, so we know how that works. And it appears that from a little bit of testing here or there in different states, that they all have the same kind of information, a little bit written a little differently here or there. And if there is a state that does not provide for the ability of an individual to become an elected committeeman, it's an unalienable right. We'll follow the rules and the law of New York. People will file according to those rules and that law, which you're going to pretty much find all the states that have laws going to be very close to each other anyway. But we'll apply New York law. And because it's an unalienable right of an individual to have consent of their government. And this is one of the 2 major ways, and there's other ways to have consent of government, but the major ways, the real controlling factors, is controlling the courts and controlling the political process to prevent all these enemies of liberty from taking office. You know, you get these people they become elected, and next thing they know, they got this campaign going on to make gun laws and stuff. Well, these people didn't pay attention to the Constitution, did they? As a matter of fact, most people around them didn't pay attention either. That's how bad it is. That is unlawful. If an individual runs for office and then raises their hand to support and uphold the Constitution, and then they go and try to get rid of an unalienable right like the Second Amendment, I mean, they're not upholding it, are they? They're denying the people's liberty, the right to protect themselves. And we're talking, and the purpose of the Second Amendment is to make sure and secure a free state. In other words, to protect ourselves from, quote-unquote, government tyrants. Okay? So, that's unlawful, and that's bad behavior. And anybody who does those things, when we, the people, take power and authority, anybody who starts to try to, get rid of our rights, try to make laws that is repugnant to our Constitution, we have one warning to give them, to cease and desist those activities. And the second after that is to remove that person. There is no other choice. They don't deserve that position, and they certainly are an enemy of the people, enemy of the Constitution. They war against the Constitution when they attack the Constitution, particularly with our unalienable rights. So again, this is how powerful these positions are. This is control of your government. This is consent. You're saying, yeah, okay, we agree. Good, go ahead. No, we don't agree. Stop or we're going to remove you. You see, that's consent of government, consent of the people, consent of government by the people. Okay, one other thing before we go to the questions. I mentioned before we're going to have some, every week we have a subject, and we're going to work in there how to petition. All petitions are pretty much the same, okay? There's nothing really that would be from New Jersey to New York or Connecticut or Washington or California or Texas. It doesn't matter. The petition is a petition, okay, as long as the criteria that's required is there, okay? And that's what we will be teaching. And we will do a PowerPoint video. We'll teach it on a Monday night, and we'll do a PowerPoint video. It will be posted also in the same place we mentioned earlier where you could have downloaded tonight's reading, and that would be under education on the bottom. Click on weekly topics, and that's where you'll find it. We'll also post it in the committee man place where people go to sign up for committee man. So we'll put it in two places. So it'll be a PowerPoint video, probably about 45 minutes, okay, and it'll walk through step by step, point by point, on how to fill out that petition and how to deal with it, where to put it, how to file it. Another evening, we'll talk about election law, maybe the differences between the states, a little detail here or there that may be a little different in Connecticut than in Jersey that we should know. And we'll separate, we'll put a page together, we'll separate it, so people in Jersey will be able to look up their state and say, okay, here's the kind of quirky things or certain things that they should realize or know, particularly in their state that might be a little different than other people's states. We're also, the petition, filing of the petition, again, will be taught how to. There'll be other subject matters, I'm sure, on the committee man. The power and the authority of the committee man, we'll do a video on that also, a PowerPoint video. We'll post it up, again, on those both places, the weekly topics and where the committee man is. We may do some things on the administrators for the juries. But we're writing a book for that, so that'll be posted eventually. And we'll have some of that book, of course, inside our course, and we'll have some, of course, and that whole thing will be inside the book that we're writing, which will bring everything together. Pretty much everything we have in NLA will be in that book, as far as law is concerned and access to the court, the political process, what's the difference between law and equity, and all these subject matters that we're talking about. And again, that book's going to be written in such a way that you'll be able to use it as a reference book. You'll be able to look up into an index or something and find exactly what you're looking for and get the details. And it also would be a book to assist in court if you're representing yourself, if coming in improper, you know. So you'll be able to use that for that, too. But again, we'll be doing that and posting these instructional videos, informational videos, teaching on the law, you know. Again, the rules of the common law court that's written here, we're going to do a PowerPoint on that. So we'll have it both in PowerPoint and in writing. Plan to save the Republic. We'll have that in PowerPoint and in writing, and so on. And we'll be posting that weekly. Hopefully I'll be able to keep up with that, but we'll be posting that weekly on a weekly basis. Now, going back to the paralegal, anybody who has some familiarity with reading law or is a paralegal and would like to volunteer to assist us in pulling out, drawing out certain information within the election laws of the different states. And I'll train the person and give them bullet points of exactly what keywords could be used to try to find these different clauses and phrases in order to bring them together and make the details out for each state. Now, let me see. I think this was in, was this? No, it wasn't there. Let me see. Maybe it was in Plan to Save... Where did it go? Okay, here. Plan to Save the Republic. I think there was a listing there. I don't know if I updated it. I think I did. If not, I will update it. On that particular paper, if you go down to page... Still going down. Okay, here it is. If you go down to page 21 of 23... Right on the top of that page is time for filing petition for committeemen, and it's a chart by state. Now, that particular chart that I have up here right now is wrong. I'll be posting the new chart. I'll do that tonight or tomorrow morning, or tomorrow sometime. I'll post the correct chart on this. I'll change that paper. But most of the committeemen running really is going to be, there's a few states that might run in February. And a lot of them are running in March, April, and May and June, okay? So it's between those months. Each state runs kind of a different time. As far as filing their petitions, now that's as best as I can figure out with, you know, searching things on the Internet to get the information. But once we get someone going through these election laws for each of the states, one of the things we'll be drawing out is the timing of petition filing and petition walking. And they're very quirky about this. Let's say they say opening up for walking of your petitions is April 1st, let's say. And usually they give you 5 to 6 weeks to walk your petition. So if you're going out to be a committeeman, by the way, you only need at maximum 20 signatures. I don't know of anyone that needed more than 20. In my election district, I only needed, I think, 8 or 9. I got 10. Okay. I mentioned this last week, I think, or the week before, that a friend of mine, the only signatures he needed to get was his wife and himself, because they were the only two Republicans in that particular election district. It was a very sparse area, and he was the only Republican there, him and his wife. So he only had to get his wife's signature to become a committeeman and his own. So that's two signatures. So this is not a big thing. This is not a big deal. You don't have to get lots and tons of signatures. When we walk signatures for individuals that we want to support to get onto the ballot, okay, remember, this is collective. If you got, let's say, Dutchess County, the county I live in, because I know it, we have 49 committeemen in the entire county. 249 committeemen in the entire county. And let's say we want to support a particular person for office and we need so many hundreds of signatures or so many thousands of signatures. 48 individuals walking their petitions might only need to get 10 or 15 or 20 signatures maximum for that individual. While they're getting their own, you know, 5 or 6 or whatever. And you can get 20 for yourself, too. Why not do an overkill? But in any event, and whoever else you're walking, whoever petitions you're walking, it'll be grouped out, meted out, you know, be organized. And again, this will be part of the planning on how to do things, and, you know, we'll give you a good structure, but then, you know, you may figure out better ways to do it, so you do what you want to do. We're free people, just as long as we accomplish the end goal. But, you know, going out and get the signatures, pretty simple. And it doesn't take long, not a lot of time. And again, you don't have to put a lot of time into this. Here's the other thing. On election day itself, okay, all committeemen should be at their election district at least maybe 15, 20 minutes before the closing of the polls. I mean, you could be there all day if you want. There are paid monitors. There are different monitors that watch. They're called watchers and monitors, and so on. But the committeeman has the power and the authority to force a counting of the vote. We don't care about their machines. You can take a tally. We're going to confirm it, you know. Trust but verify, you know. So they're there to make sure when the polls are closing that the counting of the vote is done in public, okay? And it's not a big task, really. Just think about it, you know. Each election district has committeemen, and there are two committeemen in each, you know, one for each party. And someone might bring up the point, well, what about the independent or some other party? They don't have any power or authority, and that's why we don't include them. Anybody that's in a different party, you should really seriously think, if you're going to become a committeeman, don't even bother doing it in the independent party, right? Because there's no power there. There's no authority. There's nothing. You know, you go to the Board of Election. On the right side, you have the Republicans. On the left side, you have the Democrats. I went up into Albany once, and they literally have this halfway, like a half a wall between the two. It's like dividing the two little worlds, the Republicans and the Democrats. I didn't even see a crossover. I don't know. But in any event, you know, those are the ones that have the party power. So people should change parties just for that purpose. And if you're going to change parties, you know, look, I chose to be a Republican, not because I agree with the Republicans, but because, you know, the concept of being a Republican to begin with is why I became a Republican. And so the Republican Party doesn't represent my views, generally speaking. I mean, under the rule and the authority of Trump, it certainly does. So he's taken the party in a good direction. But that's what we need to do. But if you're going to sign up, try signing up becoming a Democrat. The whole process is not picking a philosophy, because we should not have philosophies. As a matter of fact, the ideal or the idea, and we discussed this back in, I think it was 2012, when we had a committeeman convention in Kingston, New York, where we had about, I don't know, 30 or 40 elected committeemen in both parties. We rewrote the rules. One of the things was, at some point in time, we need to get rid of parties. You know, when George Washington was elected, there was no parties. When Thomas Jefferson was elected, and he was the third president, or Adams the second, there was no parties. But parties came into being, and they've done nothing but destroy. You know, they politicized everything. Everything is, my group needs to be better than your group, getting the edge over the other group, and getting your desires and whatever, philosophy, strategy. No, we got a constitution. We don't need political parties. And you know what? If we did exercise that constitution and require it to be exercised and the people to be obedient to it, we just solved all problems. There's absolutely no reason to make an argument of political, you know, an argument of politics, okay? No reason at all. It doesn't belong there. We've already gave the instructions on how this government is to run, what the authorities are, what the jurisdictions are, and they have to do the right thing, not the politically, you know, the political thing, the right thing, the just thing, the good thing, the beneficial thing, you know? In our Constitution, you know, we have that preamble, and in that preamble is the prime directive. And anything any of these people do in government, they need to be fulfilling one of these prime directives. And let me just read these prime directives to you real quickly, and then we'll get back on track here. But we, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, so that was the one thing, to form a more perfect union, and it is a pretty good union we created. Second, establish justice. So whatever they're doing has to do one or more of these directives. To make a more perfect union, to establish justice, that's two. Ensure domestic tranquility, that's three. Provide for the common defense, that's four. Promote the general welfare, that's five. Secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, that's six. So anything they do should be fulfilling at least one or more of those six prime directives that we the people gave to those people who we have elected to run our nation. But they certainly are not to govern us. They're certainly not to rule or lord over us. So we can get rid of the parties over time. That's something that's going to take some time. You know, the idea of a party, the idea of a Democrat or Republican party came into mind during Jefferson's day, where a lot of the people that were supporting Jefferson, you know, there was different names. For instance, one of them, they called themselves Jeffersonians, I think, or something like that. Another group called themselves why can't I think of that? Well, I'll think of it later, maybe. One of the other names was the Democratic Republicans, okay? And the idea, of course, was that it was a Republican government, but we chose our representatives democratically and in the sense of a vote, you know, the majority elected the individual. But Jefferson never signed up for that. He never endorsed that. But the people who were believing in his thinking, they're the ones that agreed to that kind of thinking. But it wasn't a party yet. And I don't know whether they ever came to a Democratic Republican Party. I don't think that ever existed. But just the idea of the form was thrown out there. And eventually the Republicans against the Democrats. So they kind of, what they did is they split Jefferson. And by the way, both parties try to claim Jefferson, just like they try to do, well, Jefferson particularly. I think Lincoln was the first Republican president, if I recall. I was thinking of it, the anti-federalists, okay? You know, you had the Federalists, and Jefferson was a Federalist per se. You know, he agreed with the federal government, but he became an anti-federalist. Him and James Madison particularly, and the anti-federalist, really their idea was to bring federal government small. They wanted the states to have more power than the federal government, which is the way it should be, and which is the way we are structured, by the way. The only problem is we don't use our Constitution, you know. Maybe we should sell it, I don't know, if we're not going to use it. All right, anyway, let me move on to other things. Let's go to the questions, Jen.
Okay, first question. Can you talk to us about the joinder and what happens if we have already filed a notice of appeal? Do we need to rescind the notice or take any action? Also, what happens if a brief on the appeal is already filed or almost filed? Do we rescind that?
Well, look, at you know, you should do everything you can to stretch out your case, to bring it as far into the future as possible, so that maybe at some point in time when we can get sanity back into our courts, that we can have courts of justice, and then hopefully at that point open your case, you know, get your case heard. And I don't think that's too far away, because, again, our ability to take control and authority it depends on two things, and two things only. Number one, the power vacuum has to be in place. That means that the deep state has to be totally, you know, being brought to justice. And once that happens, there'll be a power vacuum. And so the second thing needed is the people to fill that power vacuum. And how do they fill it? By becoming committee men, taking control of the political process, and becoming administrators to take control of the judicial process and bring it back under the Constitution and require these people to obey the Constitution. So we need critical mass and the deep state to be kaputs. Now, that's happening as we speak. Anybody watching the news, and the real news that is, and paying attention particularly, and again, I'm going to bring this up again, what's it called? I don't know why I can't think of the name of that. But what's the news media we have that we push? Let me go look on the website.
X22.
X22. Thank you very much. That and the Black Conservative Patriot. Although those two particular places, okay, in my opinion, give some of the best stuff. They're not the only ones. And from time to time, you get some great stuff other places too. But these two guys are very consistent, constantly right on point, right on top of things, really bringing information together, and the truth is obvious, you know? So if you're paying attention to what's really going on, you can see things are about to happen big, big time. And it's got to happen. Definitely got to be happening before the next election, no doubt about that. So sometime between now and maybe the next 6 months at most, I think before this year is out, this is going to be a big, big thing. And so as we're coming into January and February, you know, I think the collapse will be in total motion. So again, you know, we need to hit critical mass for that. And how do we hit critical mass? One of the things we need is to be able to get out on the radios and different places where we can get the word out to patriots. So again, if anybody has or knows any radio stations or anything, get that, that we might be able to get onto. Maybe you can set the stage and Jan will get a hold of them and set up an appointment or a time that I can go and speak or that Gerard can speak. But we got to get the message out. That's how we're going to get critical mass. We're very close, you know, because we got almost 8,000 members at this point. So, and we're growing every day, every week, every month. But we need to grow quicker. We need to really hit that critical mass button, and I think it's coming up. So those two things are required to get to that point. But going back to the case, notice of they got appeal going in. Yeah, I'd still do the appeal. That doesn't mean you still can't file the papers with us. Let them both go through at the same time. Or maybe the more maybe the wiser thing is to see if the appeal wins. If you get the appeal and it wins, fine. If it doesn't, then you go this route. You can sign up a joinder with us. So probably the wise thing to do is let the appeal go through and then sign in a joinder with us if you don't win the appeal. You're probably not going to win the appeal because you're probably up against the government or big corporations, and they're not going to let you win. Very difficult to win anyway. All right, what are the questions you got?
Okay, can you challenge jurisdiction even if you have a warrant for failure to appear? And if so, is there anything that needs to be done prior to filing the motion to show cause?
Well, challenging the jurisdiction is the key. And they don't have it. Even if they look real, and even if they got a grand jury indictment, and even if they have a jury trial going on, they don't really have jurisdiction. Why? Because the Rule 2. Go to Rule 2 and look at it. They are under civil law. We're not under civil law. We're under natural law. So they don't have the jurisdiction over us. That's a court, a foreign court, with jurisdictions unknown. And they certainly do make the rules up as they go. Anybody who's been in the courts knows that. They just make these rules up. You know, there's so many times it's clear cut on what this judge has to do. Everything's clear on the paper. There's no direction for him to go but the right direction. And yet, they'll make a new rule up and they'll go the wrong direction because that's what they do. And that's what we're up against and that's what we're fighting. So it's an uphill battle, no doubt. What was the question again? Make sure I get it.
Can you challenge jurisdiction even if you have a warrant for failure to appear?
Yeah. Yes, you can. Problem is they won't hear it without getting you there, so that could be a problem. But you could try challenging it. Challenge it by paper. Give them a default because they won't answer it. And at least those two things will be sitting there. The other thing you could do is to move it into a higher court yourself, particularly a federal court, because they're the ones that have the authority to hear a constitutional issue. So if your right of due process is being violated, which if you have a statutory jury, it's being violated. If you have a statutory grand jury, it's being violated. If you have a statutory court, it's being violated. So you can challenge that in the federal court, and you potentially could win, but remember, they like to maintain the status quo. So look at the really only option we really have is what we're doing right now in the courts. That's the real only option we have. We have to take the courts back so we can bring justice back into our courts to get these courts operating under the rules of the common law. Next.
My employer is threatening to terminate me because I am not receiving flu vaccine. The options they present me with are filing a religious, moral, or ethical exemption form or being vaccinated. However, I feel both of these avenues are unconstitutional because it's not a religious issue, but rather encroachment on my liberty. I now have to go before a board or committee to see if I can keep my job. Can you give me some advice on this?
Sure. Do an Article 78. Bring it into the state court. Article 78, which is a show cause. By what authority? I presume they live in New York, huh?
I'm not sure what state it was.
Yeah, they probably live in New York. Anyway, do a show cause. Bring it into the state court. You know, the Supreme Court here. I presume you're in New York, but if you're in another state, bring it into your state court. Open up a court of record. Challenging under Article 78, which is a show cause, you should be able to, if I recall, doing Article 78, I think there's only a small fee for that. You shouldn't have to pay anything, but you don't have to, I don't think with an Article 78, you have to go out and get your index number and what's the other thing for the judge to intervene. Go that route first. You may win, but if you don't, it doesn't matter because you open up a court of record and then you challenge the jurisdiction that the judge has stolen your jurisdiction and moved you into jurisdictions unknown. Therefore, you're not getting your due process and you move it to federal court for cause. I'm sure you'll probably win on the federal level in that particular kind of a case. They don't want to make a big stink about it to begin with, and they like to quietly deal with it. But I think you'd have a good chance of winning in the federal. I think the federal judge, if you really bring it in and produce it correctly, you know, writing your papers good and correct, making your point clear. And remember, here's the other thing on an Article 78. They most likely are going to default, although they'll get a lawyer maybe, and then the lawyer will respond to that. So maybe that's not the case. But again, they have nothing. They can't force you. This is your body. You have an unalienable right to your body. Nobody else has a right to touch your body or to do anything to your body except you. And that's a violation of one of your unalienable rights to force you to do something that you believe is dangerous. Matter of fact, that we know is dangerous. So I wouldn't get the shot. Next.
I bought a home in West Virginia and paid for the property in total at closing by a cashier's check or cash payment. I am now being billed for property taxes because of the cost of a mortgage and insurance to the county. But I did not ever use a mortgage, and I purchased and paid for my own homeowner's insurance. So why do I owe property taxes?
Well, you don't. That's unlawful tax. It's a direct tax. It's a tax on property. You're renting your property. You don't own your property. You can find that out real quick. Just stop paying it, and you'll discover they'll take it away from you. Okay? So what I would do is I would continue to pay it, but I'd take them to court and fight it. What you want to fight for is to remove your property from whatever, you know, they usually have a residential. I think that's generally what houses mostly are under. I know here in New York it's residential. I'm sure it's everywhere the same way. So you have residential, you want to move it into private property. Once you move it into private property, in theory, there is, I've heard that there is a category for that, and if you do fall into that category, no taxes. So you can try doing that. It's a fight uphill. They may declare or try to argue it doesn't exist. Well, then I'll be the only house that exists. I want to move it there. You don't have, you know, they don't have a right. That's a direct tax, and it's unlawful. Can you win that? You might be able to win it. I've heard some people have been able to win those kind of cases. Difficult, worth trying, but all that's going to disappear on the other side of things. Okay. And that's a lot of that may really count on the people taking control. If we, the people, take control, no doubt we can get rid of it. If we don't take control, I don't think it's going to go away. Clearly, the Federal Reserve is going to go away soon. Trump is planning to get rid of that and bring us back to gold and silver, real money. And so, therefore, direct taxes will be gone away. You know, that doesn't mean that Congress can't put certain taxes on commercial activity, because of course they do. That is a lawful tax. Why can they do that and get away with it? Because it's not a direct tax. And if the people don't want to pay the tax, then you don't purchase that service, whatever that might be, that commercial activity or that service. But anyway, that will go away if we the people take control, and definitely go away. You know, people worry about Agenda 21, and they should be. But when the people take control, it's unlawful. The whole thing is unlawful. We'll shut it right down real quick. And so we don't have to worry about fighting those battles now, because they're uphill battles. You probably won't win anyway. But if we win the war, we've taken care of all of those battles. So need to get into power, take control, have government by consent, change the processes back to the way they should be, making them just, and making these people obey their oaths. And then we'll have a true republic. Next.
The John Birch Society constantly warns and stresses against ratification of the United States, Mexico, and Canada agreement. If passed, they claim that it could further destroy the sovereignty of the USA and initiate a North American Union modeled after the European Union. President Trump seems to really advocate this, and so do many Republican congressmen. I don't know if Trump is just playing reverse psychology, like the gun control bait, or is he serious about its ratification? What is NLA's concern on this matter, and what are NLA's plans if this becomes a reality?
Well, anything that upsets our government as far as our republic and, you know, puts in jeopardy our Constitution, we definitely will stop it. And the people will and have the power to do it. And get back again, if we take on the committeeman process and we take the administrative process, we can stop anything, especially that, because it's repugnant to the Constitution. But the plan that Trump has going, and again, I haven't read it, so I can't say for sure, I can't believe that he would allow any kind of a connection that would affect our republic in any way. But surely it sounds really good to have a good trade plan with our two major neighbors and even make that connection between our neighbor on the south and our neighbor on the north. Why not? And I think Trump is going to, that's where his focus is at, get business going and things happening. We definitely should be doing that. But as far as making some kind of a union to become one together in something in a political sense, in a constitutional sense, well, of course not. And I don't believe that Trump would really support that kind of a thing. So I don't think it's a real bad thing. Maybe someone could get a hold of the plan and read through it, take some notes, and talk to us about it. So, next.
Okay, that's all the questions I had, John.
Okay, great. Has anybody found Brent? Brent, are you here? I don't see him on the top of the list here. And Brent, if you're here, jump into the queue, and hopefully we should recognize you and unmute you. But I guess he's not here. Gerard, are you here?
Yep.
You want to take the open forum here? I'll kind of pipe in here and there.
Sure.
You got the board?
Yeah.
Okay. By the way, anybody that was in last week, that was in the queue and you didn't get a chance, we had a lot of people in the queue and we shut down. Now is the time to get into the queue. Star 6. We only have 3 people in the queue, so star 6. Anybody else, in a minute or two, you can jump into the queue also. Star 6 and a 1. Okay, you got it. I don't know if you know this, but the best way to open a person up is to hit that phone instead of the next button. You know?
Yeah. Yep. So. All right.
Okay.
Okay. I don't know who this is. There's no name, no state. So
yeah, first name and state.
Hi, it's Jeff Paul.
Jeff, how you doing?
Good. How are you? I just wanted to chime in on the order to show cause Article 78 issue that you brought up. In New York State, it's $315 for an index number for an Article 78.
They do want you to pay the $315, huh?
Yes, but I mean, you certainly can make a motion for, inform a Papa's motion.
Right, well, I'd like to make a motion for, I'm under common law, leave me alone and don't charge me for justice, but we're not going to get there that way, so we're stuck with paying that money. I think it's $210 for the index number and $95 for the judicial intervention, I think they call it.
Yeah, good point. It depends on which court you're going in. But, yeah, if you're going at the Supreme or County Court level in New York State, that's correct. And it's $45 for every motion.
Well, I'll tell you what I did. Okay, is it the two fifteen? I think it's 215 for the index, right?
210.
Okay, and then 95 for the intervention, right?
Yes.
Okay, this is what I have always done when I used to file cases in the state court. I only get the index number, the 210. Okay. A lot of states, they have it all combined together. The feds do $400, it's all together. But New York breaks it up into two pieces. I've always just done the index number, and I file my papers, and the other side gets frustrated because they want to get into court real quick so they can use that Rule 12 on you and all that. So they'll pay the $95. So let them pay the $95.
Yeah, and that's a good point. And also they may make a motion. Of course, you probably have to cross move, so you have to pay the $45 anyway, but...
And the other thing is, though, if they're really dumb, and I can assure you most lawyers are dumb, they think they're smart, and they're very well educated in minuality for the New World Order, if that's such a word, but being minions for the New World Order. I watch them and see what they do. They're really dumb. They're stupid. And all their papers are the same. It's all chicken scratch and very elementary. Not much support, no footnotes. I mean, it's really, really very, very simple. And but the thing is this, they may be brain dead enough not to know to push that $95 and think that they can sit around on an index number and they can go past the 30 days. And they'll have a really harsh lesson to learn after that 30 days because you'll file your paper for affidavit of default, and you still don't have to pay the $95 as long as your papers were well written, as far as the wherefore clause is in place, and you're very specific on the details of what you're looking for, and there's nothing ridiculous like I'd like $1 trillion, there's nothing ridiculous in there. Then you'll never see a judge. You'll take it right down to the clerk, file your affidavit of default. They'll give you your papers, make your seal on it, and take it to the sheriff. And go for collection.
And on that point, which is a very, very good point for anyone listening, but you might want to reconsider and not do an order to show cause, but instead do a notice of petition and petition. Because when you do an order to show cause, you're getting a judge involved. You're asking a judge to set a hearing date, it's. They say it's a way to move it along faster, but no judge has to sign an order to show cause.
If you're doing just to show cause, ordering to show cause, that doesn't necessarily bring in the judge. Because, again, whether there's a judge there or not, let's say you pay the 95 and you bring the judge in, okay? And so now you have the judge in play, and you got the other side, but the other side sits and waits, and they go past the 30 days, and you file your affidavit of default, and you go down and get your papers, certified for that affidavit of default to take to the sheriff. You still don't have to see the judge, and you'll never see him.
Right.
Again, as long as, A, you don't have something ridiculous in your wherefore clause, you know, and, B, you're very specific on what you're asking for, there's no interpretation, the mathematics of whatever penalties, restoration required is laid out clear, that the clerk can go along with it, and they can, judge never touches it.
Right. And, yeah, for anyone listening, I mean, that may be a reason why you don't want to do an order to show cause, because an order to show cause,
I know, is there a difference between a show cause and an order to show cause? Because I've always just done a show cause.
No, it's the same thing.
Any time you file a paper in a court, someone is ordered to respond to it, and if they don't, they default. So everything, in a sense, you know, any kind of a paper you file brings that into play, so to speak. So I don't know that would affect even on Article 78.
Well, as far as I know, you cannot just serve an order to show cause and set a date and time. That is the whole point of an order to show cause. The main purpose is to speed things up.
Yeah, you're right. I realize that. But, okay, you could do a show cause without calling it an Article 78, you know, where people need to respond. But, yeah, you make a good point on that one. You're right. The 78 makes it speedy.
Yeah, but what did you call it, Jeff? You said a notice of petition of a petition? Say that again.
Well, so you have two, with an Article 78 in New York, you have two ways to go with respect to an Article 78 petition, the whole point is to make a government agency do something or not do something. So in New York, you can either do an order to show cause, which they say is a way to speed it up, so to have a judge set it, you know, for like tomorrow rather than requiring a 20-day notice, which is normal.
Yeah, but you have to do it under Article 78, which is a code, in order to expedite it for that purpose. So you're right. But if you're not calling forth that particular statute to move the process. And by the way, if you're that individual, were they working for a government agency or something? I'm sure they probably were. They probably were.
Yeah, well,
that being the case, then using the code would be yeah, exactly. They have an administrative process, so using the code would push it in. So you're right.
Right, I believe though, from everything that I know that you're talking about, you know, that we talk about at NLA, and also from what I know about Article 78 and what the procedures are, I would believe that. And to answer now, Gerard, I would believe that rather than do an order to show cause, I think it would probably be better to do a notice of petition and petition, because you're putting it, and you want to make sure your petition is verified, so it's sworn to. So now you've got a sworn document, you know, saying all the facts, and you put them on a 20-plus day notice in order to respond to your papers. And then, you know, like you said, if they don't respond, you can file a default.
And that heading is notice of petition and petition?
Yes.
Is that what you said?
Yeah, but there's different ways to do that. It doesn't have to be with that those words. You can use the words, that they need to show cause, but don't bring in the Article 78, which executes the speed. Okay, if you don't file it with that code, then it's not going to run into that category. But look at almost everything we do when government does something wrong and you go in and you're doing, you know, show cause. By what authority do you think you act? And so on and so forth. And that just goes through the normal process. But you could call it different names as Jeff is bringing up. And you called it a notice of petition, right?
Well, so you have two documents. You have your notice of petition, and then you have your petition, or should be your verified petition.
So yeah, a notice of some kind of an action, so yes.
Right.
Which is usually a one pager on top, maximum two.
Yeah, for your notice of petition, correct, yeah. But, you know, the only thing that I would like to caution people on, though, is that, you know, if you use different language, you know, language that they've never seen before or they're not familiar with, who knows what kind of results you're going to get. An Article 78 is done by one of those two ways in New York, and I believe that the notice of petition is your best way, because you're putting them on notice, you're swearing to it, and it's on record. You know, they have an obligation to respond. Anyway, that's my two cents on that topic.
All right. Yeah, I'm looking for there's the instructions. Okay, now we do have. I don't know why I can't find it right now. Maybe it's under education. Let's see. Yeah, education. If you go up to education, you click on court forms, process, and instructions. Okay, and you have to be a premium member to get to this page. And again, a premium member is someone that gives $5 a month or more. That's $60 a year. That's one cup of coffee and a bagel and cream cheese or something a month. That's all. You just got to give up one coffee and one bagel or a donut or something, and that's your $5. Huh?
And locks.
And locks. Okay.
Bagel, cream cheese, and locks.
There you go. Okay, but we do have those papers up here, and what we call it is a notice of motion, okay? And your notice of motion is really a top page, which is where Jeff is talking about a notice of petition. You could do it that way, too. I kind of like the notice of motion because petition is more like permissional things, and motion is saying, hey, I'm moving to court. This is where we're going, like it or not. And and in order for that court not to go that – when you move the court in a different direction, by law, it's got to go in that direction. Someone else can try to block it, but it's got to be the person on the other side, not the judge, to block it. And then if no one blocks it, then that motion goes through. And in this case, it's in the beginning of a case, you get a notice of motion. And as you're moving through a case, if you want to make a motion for the court to move the court somewhere, you got to give them a notice of motion. And again, it's usually a one-page notice. And I'll just quickly read. It's a short paragraph. It says, you are hereby summoned to answer the attached show cause, or notice of motion, whatever it is. In this case, it's show cause. And to serve a copy of your answer on the petitioner within 30 days after completion of service via United States Postal Service. In case of your failure to answer, judgment will be taken against you by default for relief demanded in the show cause. So this is a general thing. And
right.
And again, you can use the word petition, and I'm sure there's other words you can use too.
Actually, what I like about doing it the way you just described is that most lawyers are going to look at it as if you did something wrong. You're just using the wrong words. You meant that it was a notice of petition, and they're going to treat it, you know, how they think it's supposed to be.
And hopefully they'll default.
Exactly. No, exactly. So I actually kind of like that.
Yeah.
Because like you said, I mean, if they want to have it deemed something other than what we describe it as, they have to make application to the court and ask the judge to rule on that. So, so I kind of like that. I kind of like the idea of doing a little differently from what they might expect.
Mm-hmm.
But anyhow, okay, cool. I want to add, though, I have you and John, you and Gerard on here. I mean, I would certainly be happy to help do legal research.
Oh, yeah, yeah. What we'll do is we're going to try to get someone to collect all of the state election laws. So we'll get someone else to do that. And then we'll get together and I'll give you the keywords and give you some language that you find in New York, and then you got to kind of search them out. I found New Jersey very quickly. And I also saw, and it's very tricky words. You know, petition for the election at the primary election. And that's kind of tricky the way that's how New Jersey said it. And again, it's sort of doesn't say that the committee man is elected at the primary election, but actually it does say that. You know, it's just that the way they word it, it's obscure. So that's what those are the paragraphs we need. That and when the petitions are filed, and you run for committee man yourself, so you know that there's a filing date, and you have to get your signatures between a certain date. If you get your signatures, let's say, I was talking about April, for instance, so you got 6 weeks usually to walk petitions. So if you get your signature before April 1st, they won't count it. And if it ends on the second week or the second Tuesday of the following month, which would be May, let's say, anything after, they won't accept it. And so you have to get it within that window. And also, if there is someone running against you, and if they got the same signatures, whoever got that signature first, and it'll be dated on the paper, gets to keep that signature. That's why, you know, I needed like seven or eight signatures, and I got 10 or 12, whatever it was, and that was sufficient. But bear in mind, the likelihood of anyone running for committee man, okay, is pretty slim, because, again, we haven't found any elected committee men except for the ones we taught.
Right. So, I mean, I actually, the last time...
And Lenny Roberto.
I called Lenny on my situation. The last time I ran a couple years ago, I was the only one that had a committee man petition, and they forced a primary. I never challenged it, but I think I would have, well, potentially won on a challenge.
Well, you really didn't have to challenge it. You could have taken to the court with the fact that you had run for a committee man, and they were just running for the position of the party position. I'm running for the elected party, for the elected position. And,
well,
you know,
challenge.
You're not challenging the other individual. You're challenging the Board of Election, because the Board of Election failed to see and understand the law, and you're correcting the law. And since the New York State Constitution, and this would be correct in any state anyway, it doesn't matter by default, if you're the only one running for the election in the primary for a committee man, and there is no challenger, and then you are deemed elected, because there's no one can run against you. You already got your own vote. You're in, you know?
Right, right. No, I mean, 100% correct, except that they don't look at it that way. I even filed a complaint with the democratic appointed woman there that's in charge of, you know, the legal issues, and she just gave me a rubber stamp denial that was totally incorrect, you know, baseless.
Because they don't understand the law. They don't understand the Constitution. They're just following the party line, and they're told that we have so much problems with bureaucrats because what they're being told by the people around them, instead of knowing what the law is, and the people around them knowing what the law is and teaching them, so nobody knows it. They get what they want because they're out of control.
She also said there was a certain time frame that I missed the time frame to file a complaint. But my argument back to her, which she never responded back again, was that no, that time frame that you're citing does not apply here, and I don't think there is any statute of limitations. I think I could still challenge it because there isn't anything in the. I've read all of New York State election law. There's nothing in there that says that in this situation, you know, that I had to do something within a certain time frame. So I believe that I'm still the elected committeeman for my district.
Oh, you are.
Based on that.
Yeah, you are, absolutely. But you're not going to be recognized, unfortunately. And even if you were, you'll just become one of the appointed, because they'll treat you as an appointed committee man. And by the way, for everyone to know, and people who have been paying attention, they do know this, if you are the only elected committee man in your state, in the entire state, you rule. You get to appoint everybody. Now, you got to win in court. And we will fight that battle at the proper time. But you will win in the court if we have courts of justice that will apply the law, because that's the law. And therefore, you'd be able to appoint everyone into position and train them and teach them, you know, to become committeemen that are constitutionalists, you know?
Yep. So. That was so huge.
All okay, we've got to move on.
More time, but yeah. Have a good night, folks. Take care. Thank you, John.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Okay, next victim. It's area code 224. I don't have a name. Go ahead. Name and state.
I'm muted.
Oh, that's Brent. Is that you, Brent?
Yeah, here we go. Now I'm in. Yeah, this is the only way I knew to get in, so I thought I'll just get in the queue. If somebody hollers at me that way, I'll...
Okay. Why don't you give a call to Jan during the week, and he'll help set you up, because I know it's a little difficult figuring some of this stuff up on the app, but Jan will help you set that up, and then you'll be able to deal with it. You want to take the mic for a while?
Yeah.
Okay. Let me introduce you. This is Brent Winters, the author of The Excellence of the Common Law. His website is commonlawyer.com. Brent, you got the mic?
Thank you.
Gerard, pick it back up when he's done.
Okay.
And thank you, Gerard, and all you gentlemen over there somewhere along the Hudson River or up upper state New York. And my comments are my own, as always, and I make them on my own cognizance, and they may or may not be the opinion of the leaders of NLA, National Liberty Alliance. We've been going through the Constitution of the United States clause by clause and blow by blow, and we've gotten to Article 2. Article 2, Section 1, Clause 5. You don't have to remember that. It's always Section 1, 2, 3, usually. Clause 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. But the main thing is it's in Article 2. Article 2 talks about the executive branch of the United States government. Our government has three branches that grow out of a common tree trunk. That common tree trunk is the written Constitution of the United States. And that tree is rooted deep in what we call our common law. They used to call it in years past, far back as the 14th century and 13th century, it was called law of the land. And even our Constitution uses that phrase when it says the Constitution shall be the law of the land, the supreme law of the land. The reference is to common law. But what is our common law? Let's just put it on the line. Again, it bears repeating over and over and over. Our common law does not include due process. Our common law is due process. That is all of what it is. It's all about. It stresses foremost how things are to be done, not what is to be done, but how. The distinction must be made. Our common law is about due process. That is why due process is among all the rights that our Constitution says the national government, the general government in Washington, D.C. will protect. Due process is the biggest. It's so big and so important and so overwhelming that even our Supreme Court and our other federal courts and our state courts have said over and over again, we don't know what it is. We don't know what it is until the need arises in any particular instance and circumstance. What is required? There have been many ways many devices, no, that's not a good word, many things, things, that we have used to achieve the what our common law calls due process, the process that is due and owing. And put it another way, our common law is not a list of laws. It is a way, a course to follow. And the particular instance will dictate what course at any given moment, what the next step has to be. Bottom line, the process, due process, the course to be followed, the course of the common law, as our Northwest Ordinance puts it, all of those bespeak fair play, fought a fair fight. If the fight ain't fair, it's not a common law trial. Well, it's not a trial at all. Only in common law countries do we even have trials. We go to blows, as it were. We hurl oaths. We have battle by trial instead of trial by battle. Well, we get down here to Section 1, Clause 5. It's about not the substance of who will be. It doesn't say who will be president, whether it's D.J. Trump or somebody else. That's substance. It doesn't dictate that. What it dictates, or it says always somebody who does this. No, it dictates the course, the how, the why. No person except a natural-born citizen or a citizen of the United States at the time of the adoption of this Constitution shall be eligible to the office of president. Neither shall any person be eligible to that office who shall not have attained to the age of 35 years and been 14 years a resident within the United States. Now, who is responsible to enforce this? Everything and everybody in the country. You're responsible. If you don't start screaming when people run for president that are not natural-born citizens, well, then you've failed your duty. Jindal ran for president. He was not a natural-born citizen. Senator Cruz ran for president. He was not a natural-born citizen. Obama ran for president. Nobody knows from whence he came. He was not a natural-born citizen. There have been many that have tried it. And right in recent times, it was funny, the Republicans put up three candidates over the course of the last election. Not a one of them are natural-born citizens. I named two, Cruz and Jindal. I don't know. The other one, I forget his name. It was an odd-sounding name. I think he was that fellow from down there in New Orleans. He was the governor of Louisiana or mayor of New Orleans or something. But he wasn't a natural-born citizen either. We lay it right on the line, right up front. Natural-born citizen, there are two requirements to be a natural-born citizen. Most people listening to this call are natural-born citizens. Yeah, the Republicans have three that run for president that weren't natural-born citizens, as though there aren't enough natural-born citizens in this country from whence to pick. Most of the people who live here are natural-born citizens. You have to look pretty hard to find three mugs that aren't natural-born citizens, and that's what they did. They, I don't know who they are, the people that hold the levers of power. And don't think it's not by design. They don't want a natural-born citizen. No, they want to make sure that they get somebody there that's not. Because he's compromised. A natural-born citizen has two requirements. Number one, he is born within the territorial boundaries of one of the states of the United States or one of the territories, the U.S. territories. John McCain was born in the Panama Canal Zone. It wasn't a state of the United States, but it was property. Over whom the United States had control. Over what? Over which the United States had control. So, whatever else you may think about him, he was a natural-born citizen. Senator Cruz was not a natural-born citizen. He was born in Canada, number one. He didn't meet either requirement. He was born in Canada, and his father was not a citizen. This is the second requirement. Both of your parents have to be American citizens at the time of your birth. His father was not. He was a Cuban, and all the reports was that he was in the regime of the communist Castro. This is a big deal. It's the only, to be natural born, the only office in our country that requires a natural born citizen is President of the United States. Why? Well, because it's natural. It's natural that a man is loyal to the place of his own birth. And also, he will have an affection, if he doesn't, there's something wrong with him, he will have an affection to the place or places of his parents' birth. Far as I know, my parents, I'm pretty sure, were born in the United States. And my grandparents on both sides, and my great-grandparents. But, so I can't relate to all of this personally, but I can tell you that this is important. That's why the Bible says in Deuteronomy 17 that any leaders among you shall be of you. They shall be one of you. Why? Because if they're of you, if that means from you, they will be for you, for your good. They will have a natural affinity toward you. You know, we as members, as descendants of Adam, of Adam's race, we are affectionate to the place where we were born. It's natural. I think I told this story before. I was in Montana at the State House for the Election Day sermon of 2006. They would invite men to come to make presentations, sermons in the rotunda in the Capitol building to make charges to lay charges. That means responsibilities upon those that had been elected to office. Well, I attended, and I remember I was out in front of the State House, beautiful big building up on a rise. And there was a statue of a man on a horse out there, you know. There are statues of men on horses all over the United States, but there's one there. And I thought, well, who is this? Who are they promoting? So I got to reading, and I don't remember his name. It started with an M, but he was an immigrant from Ireland. And he wound up in Montana after the war between the northern and the southern tiers of the states. He had participated, and if I remember right, he was quite the character. He ended up participating on both sides of our, at different times for reasons of preference, said that things changed. And, but at any rate, he was quite the fellow. But he wrote, they had their words that he had wrote, and he talked about the fondness of the place of his birth and the places that he played when he was a boy over in Ireland. And I said, well, that's natural. I've heard older men talk. I think that way myself now. All the fondness I have, the place where I first saw the light of day and experienced so many things, and my eyes were sensitive and open, and my ears were keen, and my wits were sharp, sharper than they are now. And everything was new to me. I have a special fondness for that place. And all the things I discovered there, everything from anthills and ants themselves, who I used to lay on the ground and watch for hours. Well, we don't want somebody to control the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, the Marines, that has a fondness for another country in any way at all. Winston Churchill had that. We wouldn't allow Winston Churchill, if he, a man like that, to lead our country or to be in that kind of a position of de facto executive officer, prime minister of the country. His father was a Brit. His mother was an American. And because his mother, Winston Churchill's mother, was an American, he had a special fondness for America. Very special. And that's why he understood American history. He was a student of American history. He knew more by far about American history than most of all Americans. Why? Well, because his mother was an American. Now, whether or not she was a British citizen at the time of his birth, I don't know. That's the test. Again, the test is you must have been born within the territorial limits of the United States. Why? Because there is such a thing among mankind as loyalty to land. We can't deny it, and if you do deny it, you're denying your own self. It's natural. Why? That's why we have what we call the law of the land. Our land, our law is about the land. The land is precious to its maker, and therefore he says it's precious to us. And it is, and he says he divided the land among the tribes and the tongues and the peoples of the earth. And the land of your birth, the land of your nativity, is supposed to be special to you. Well, even the land of the nativity of your mother and your father. Well, that's the way Winston Churchill was, and that's natural. But here in our country, we'd have said, well, no, we want you to be natural born. We want both of your citizens to be citizens of the United States at the time of your birth. Donald Trump's mother was not born in America. But was she an American citizen at the time of his birth? As far as we can tell, yes, she was. She was born on an island off the coast of Scotland. She came here and was naturalized. So, that being true, given that that is true, Donald Trump was born within the territorial limits of the United States. Both of his parents were American citizens at the time of his birth. Therefore, DJ Trump is a natural-born citizen. That's what we want. Now, his wife isn't. Well, she's a citizen. She's not a natural-born citizen. She's born in another country. Nothing wrong with that. No law says a president of the United States can't marry a woman from another country. So he's done that. Well, that was a lot. But we'll, of course, the other requirements are here. Here are you. Must be 35 years of age and 14 years a resident within the United States. Well, if you're a natural-born citizen, maybe you moved out of the country for a while. Like John McCain, he lived in other places. His father and his grandfather before him, they were all graduates of the Naval Academy like him, and they lived in different places. So if he was going to run for president, he would have had to have lived here at least 14 years immediately before he ran. That's another requirement. It's all right here. It's one sentence. It's plain. Natural-born citizen, must have attained the age of 35 years, been 14 years a resident within the United States. This clause requires, therefore, every president, save those born in Britain's American colonies before the 4th of July, 1776, must be a natural-born citizen and not a foreign-born naturalized citizen. You know, George Washington, every president, well, just in general, up through Andy Jackson, all those fellows, at least Lincoln through Washington through Jackson, were born. They weren't born in the United States. They were born in the British colonies of Britain. So they're accepted here. That's why it says, doesn't it say that? At the time of the adoption of this Constitution, right? So they had to start out that way. Our first president, George Washington, and all six presidents after Washington, that's right. Okay, George Washington and six presidents after him, plus the ninth president, William Henry Harrison, were not born in the United States, but in Britain's American colonies. I think it was William Henry Harrison. Amazingly, I'll drop a footnote here about William Henry Harrison. He was not born in the United States. He was born in the British colonies. They became the United States. William Henry Harrison's son's son, in other words, William Henry Harrison's grandson, is still alive and lives in Virginia, and so is his brother. His brother, President Henry Harrison's grandson, is still alive and lives in Virginia. It's amazing. His father was over 60 when he was born, and his grandfather was over 60 when his father was born. And when you do the math, it's almost hard to believe, but it's true. William Henry Harrison was his grandfather. He's the one that said that when he gets in political arguments and he gets tired of it, he just says to the other fellow, his antagonist, he says, well, I'll tell you what my granddad told Tom Jefferson. Because his granddad knew Tom Jefferson, for crying out loud. We're not that far removed from the past. That's, you know, what the lesson is there, I suppose. Well, our Constitution bars no loyal American, regardless of birth, from holding any public office, save one, and that is reserved for that class of citizens called natural born. President of the United States, this clause chooses the common law standard for citizenship called natural born over the Roman civil law standard called native born. The common law standard is the laws of nature, our common law, which governs the world's few common law countries. The civil law standard is from the old Roman code, which still blankets our globe. Common law says that every child whose natural parents, plural, are citizens, is a natural born citizen if he's born here. Civil law says that regardless of the parent's citizenship, any child born on the sovereign soil is the sovereign subject forever. That's tyranny. Our Constitution of the United States, being a brief of common law principles, rests upon the following first principle, and that is this: a natural born citizen would receive only a single natural loyalty from both parents. Further, no foreign state could claim his loyalty. Our common law follows the laws of nature. A child follows his parents. If the parents are split in their loyalties, the child will be split in his loyalty to America. And remember, split loyalty is no loyalty at all. Listen to this quote from the United States Supreme Court in the case Minor versus Happersett. Minor versus Happersett, 1874, says this: at common law, the nomenclature of which the framers were familiar, children born in a country of parents who both were its citizens became upon their birth citizens also. See, that's the standard. That's a natural born citizen. By the way, United States versus Wong Kim Ark of 1898 did not overturn this Supreme Court definition of a natural born citizen, as the Obamaites used to claim. Let me read it again. At common law, the nomenclature of which the framers were familiar, children born in a country of parents who both were its citizens became upon their birth citizens also. There's the double standard. Double standard. When I mean double, I mean two-pronged, as our law would say. You got to meet both requirements to fulfill what a natural born citizen is. Simply put, our Constitution requires that both parents of every president, after William Henry Harrison, must be a U.S. citizen at birth, born of parents, both being U.S. citizens, and born within the territorial jurisdiction of the United States. If it becomes clear that the man living in the White House is not a natural born citizen, both of his parents not having been U.S. citizens when he was born, the people must, that's us, the people must forthwith demand his removal. The House of Representatives must impeach him, and the Senate must try him for his crime, which is defrauding Americans in high-handed defiance of our Constitution. That's a quote from yours truly, and I wrote that when the fella called Obama was in the White House, sitting in the White House. I'll never say he was president. He never was. It's impossible to be president when you haven't met the requirements of the Constitution of the United States. I don't care whether you won the election or cheated in the election. He's just another man, just a fella sitting in the White House. That's all he was. And that's why he was challenged so often. The people in the military that challenged him on that point, whether or not he had authority to deliver orders as commander-in-chief, they were summarily court-martialed and drummed out of the service and jailed, some of them. But they were loyal Americans for doing what they did. Every American should have done it to the extent of power he had to do it. Well, this is Brent Allen Winters, commonlawyer.com. And you can go to the website. It's for fun. It's for fun. Go there and listen. There are hundreds of hours are probably of videos and MP3 clips. And we do a law class on Saturday mornings. You can see there how to participate. And also, there's one other thing I'll add, and then I'll quit. There is a trial going to happen in Everton, Missouri, southwest Missouri, on the 28th of March next year, 6:30 in the evening, 28th of March, the year 2020, a trial. I'll be for the defense, and Ted Weiland will be the prosecution, and we're going to try the question, is the Constitution of the United States biblical? is the Constitution of the United States biblical? And we're trying to work out so that can be observed live on YouTube. This is Brent. Thank you, gentlemen, for allowing me again a few words. And I yield back to you, Gerard. I think you're there.
Okay.
Yeah, before Gerard takes it, I want to ask you a question there, Brent. Do you know anything about this common law, the international common law grand jury? Are you familiar with the makings up of that jury?
No, I'm not. Tell me about who's on it.
No, I don't know. I've heard of it. I've seen some things. I've seen people speaking who claim to be a chairman or something. But it seems to be where, you know, they seem to be judges or have some kind of a qualification, and they sit on as a grand jury. You know, it doesn't seem like it's the people. That's what I'm trying to say.
No, and I'd be leery of. Number one, as we, you know, just knowing that much, if, given that that's true, number one, the jury is made up of the people. The people are the militia, and the militia only exists within countries that are sovereign. This is about the law of the land. Our common law is the law of the land. That means the land where you live, the land of your birth. And God himself has divided his land up, and he has divvied it out the way he wants to divvy it out. And anybody that claims internationalism is a fraud, and they're looking to hurt people. That's why we talk about, people used to distinguish between international communism and national communism. Germany was a country of national communism, socialism they called it, and the Bolsheviks were international communists. They were people without a country. They didn't care. I'm not saying that the Germans did the right thing, and I'm not promoting them. I'm just making the distinction. Because neither of those cases, both of those countries were governed by the law of the city. But talk about our common law is to talk about specific countries. That's the way God established it. I can't change that. I don't want to change it. I kind of like it. But if it doesn't come back to you being loyal to the land that the Lord your God has given you, as Paul the Apostle says in the book of Ephesians, well, what's the use? Without land, everything is a waste of time. Even to fight a war without gaining control of land is a water haul. It's just a waste of blood and treasure. Everything is about land, and these people that are talking about international this and international that, it's been my study conclusion, for what it's worth, they're fraudsters, and they're not just, they're more than that. They're downright dangerous. And because they don't, well, I guess I'm repeating myself. Go ahead, back to you.
Yeah, I pretty much agree with that conclusion, as much as I know. But go ahead,
John. That's the ITTS, the international blah, blah, blah. That's Kevin Annette. Remember I gave you all that paperwork on Kevin?
Yeah. I remember. That was a while back.
He's a fraud. He's bad. Really bad.
Yeah, they seem very controlling. It's just another group of tyrants, in my opinion.
Yeah, no, he's no good. He's done some bad things himself. You know, I mean, he claims to be taking care of, trafficked children, and then it turns out that he's no better than they are. So,
Yeah, well, you know, just for general purposes, a grand jury cannot sit forever. You can't have a grand jury constantly sitting and nobody else taking place of that, the makeup, you know, the people. Now, of course, in the case of what we're doing, and it'd be the case of anything, if a grand jury is in session for a very long time because of a particular subject matter that's criminal that they're investigating and involved with and so on and so forth, of course, they can sit as long as it takes to deal with that problem. And in our case here, as the Unified United States Common Law Grand Jury, we sit only as long as it takes to deal with the enemies, both foreign and domestic, that's within our government, that we're trying to remove those varmints from our government. So, but, okay, back to you, Gerard.
Okay. Of course, it's going to seem like forever, but that's another story. All right, I'm going to go to the next person here. It's 803 area code. Go ahead.
Hello?
Yeah, who's this?
This is Calvin, South Carolina.
Okay.
I have a question I have to ask you about foreclosure. Oh, I'm late. Oh, my well. Hold on, well, get away.
A foreclosure for what? A bank or for a municipality? For taxes or for a loan?
Loan.
Okay. So what's the question?
Really, I was more involved in being a representative of my grandmother's estate. And really, my concern is I had to file for a rehearing of a remuter. And the question is, can I, as the representative, am I allowed to...
When you say you're a representative, do you mean you're an official trustee?
Yes, I am the trustee of my grandmother's estate. And she died with the land in a trusted mortgage. And I tried to reconvey it back to her estate, and they tried to take it, well, the court tried to take it all, saying I didn't have a right as the trustee to do it. So now I'm back in court for a rehearing. I guess I didn't use laws or something Yeah, so the trustee mortgage. And I'm trying to see, is it really lawful or legal that I can do that after that trustee mortgage was paid off? And that's what I was doing, is reconveying it back to the estate, and they wouldn't allow me to do it.
So... the mortgage got paid off? You mean the bank got paid off? Who paid it off? I don't understand.
The bank got paid off, and by my mama, my grandma was deceased after the fact. By me being the trustee, the trusted representative of her whole estate, I was, reconveying it back to her estate. So. I can, like, reuse it in my own name or whatever,
They wouldn't let it put me.
And they wouldn't allow it. They were saying it wasn't.
Maybe Brent can respond a little bit to this. If I understand what you're saying, is that you were the trustee for your grandmother, your mother or your grandmother?
Grandmother.
Your grandmother's estate, you were the trustee. And now that she's passed, and now that there must be certain criterias that a will, for instance, on where this would go. I mean, yeah, I would imagine it should go back into the estate and then put out in a way that was under her will. How would that work, Brent, do you know?
She didn't have a will. It was just...
Yeah, but if a trust was set up, there must have been... Yeah, so at that point, you got to be careful because you're a trustee. You're not to have a personal ownership in that sense. Again, if Brent is here, maybe he can respond a little better because I don't have any knowledge there.
But the mortgage was defaulted on, so the bank took it over, apparently.
No, but he paid it off, he said.
Yeah, it was paid off.
And now he wants to... Now, who owns it at this point now that it's paid off?
It just the it's air land, and I was made representative grantor or the grantee of it, and but after it was after I couldn't, it's still in my grandmother's name.
Okay, so it's in your grandmother's name, so it still should be part of the estate, I would imagine, and now the estate has to be done with in someone's will. I don't know what the details are or what the plan was. I mean, if someone went as far as creating
a trust,
if it's a trust, the trust has to have a plan. There's a paper-written plan. I mean, What is the plan?
Yes, I was bringing it back to the estate.
Right, but what do you? Right, once it's back in the estate, which I would imagine it's automatically in the estate because it's still in her name, so it's still part of the estate. But the question becomes: is what are you going to do with that land now?
I was going to sell it to satisfy the taxes on the whole estate that I'm still paying.
We don't have enough information on that, and I don't have enough knowledge on how it works. I don't know, Gerard, do you have any real knowledge on that, on how that would work?
No, it seems to me that they're probably playing a game. In other words, they won't let her bring it back into the estate.
Exactly.
Because
you're right.
They want to steal it.
Yeah, of course they want to steal it. But it was never, removed from the estate, even though it was in a default way with the mortgage company. Once it's paid off, it's done, paid off, it's over. It is what it is. It's in part of the trust, right?
Yes, sir.
So I don't know how they can steal it.
They won't allow me to even work with it.
Out
a good name.
They got her paying the bills of the estate, though.
Her
with the bills. Right, your position should basically be in the court that, hey, look, this is part of the estate. It has nothing to do with the bills were paid off. You know, the mortgage was paid. It's part of the estate. You're not moving it back. It's in there. It belongs there. I mean, again, that would be my thinking. I don't know.
Yeah, I think he was saying they're trying to steal it. That's my...
They're saying that you can't sell it because it's in a trust, but in the meantime...
Yes, exactly.
Defaulted, and they're charging you with the bills, and isn't the property an asset of the trust? They're just playing both ends against the middle. I don't know what they're doing.
Okay.
It's legal. I don't know enough about trust law to give you advice on that. But I don't know. You need a lawyer that's good with trust, that understands trust, the ins and the outs. You know, they may even have somebody over there that doesn't. You know, they get a friendly judge, and the lawyer's working with the judge, and they just go ahead and steamroll you because they figure you don't know any better, and you're not gonna. And if you have bills, they figure you can't afford a good lawyer that's gonna go after them anyway. You know what I mean?
Exactly. You're on the right track. That's the way we feel it. About it. I did have an attorney, but he removed himself because they won't allow him. They won't allow him to do just what you're saying.
Sounds like the judge pulled him in the back room and gave him a.
Okay.
Told him, don't pursue this, or we'll take your license. You'll never practice again. It's one of those deals. I mean, Brent knows about all these evil things that they do to lawyers. You may want to give him a call just to see if he can give you some advice or something. I don't know. I know that you know he can give you better advice than I can. You know.
Okay. All right. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you so very much. Let me know I'm on the right track. My thinking was the same way. Thinking.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well,
all right.
If it smells, it usually is.
Something's
rotten.
Okay.
All right, I'm going to go to the next caller. It says John. I don't know from what state. Go ahead. John, you're
hi,
up.
Hi. I'm in
you're very low. I can hardly hear you. Can you turn your mic up or get closer?
How's this?
Oh, that's much better. There you go.
Okay. The reason I'm calling, I'm actually assisting a friend of mine with a statutory issue concerning an inspection sticker here in New York. The judge is refusing to establish jurisdiction in the case. During the arraignment and during a hearing today, the assistant district attorney tried to have me arrested for practicing law without a license, but thankfully with the information that you guys provide, I was able to combat that and shut it down immediately. The judge...
Which state is this? New York State?
New York State, yes. I'm in northern New York, Franklin County.
Okay.
And the judge basically, for lack of a better expression, it was deer caught in the headlights with the case law that I was presenting, as well as the Constitution, you know, because they basically don't operate in the Constitution. But I did get the judge backed into a corner during the arraignment to acknowledge that the proceeding should proceed under common law. And when that was brought to the assistant district attorney's attention, she became infuriated, declaring that no, it was not common law. So my question is should at this point, should we file a writ of habeas corpus, or should we just go, because I'm looking at some of the information on the site now. Should we proceed to the file on demand and you know, procedure with establishing jurisdiction?
Well, first of all,
for challenging jurisdiction, sorry.
I don't understand with the inspection sticker what rose to a criminal act or a felony or whatever. I mean normally a normal inspection sticker ticket is not even a misdemeanor. It's not.
Right. And it's not, and she has the judge has at this point adjourned it to a traffic trial, which will be, you know, a summary hearing under a different either the same judge or a different judge. She never set the next court date. She said that my friend would be notified by mail.
So this was a ticket for running an expired inspection sticker? Is that what this is about?
Yes, sir.
Oh, my goodness. And what's the most they can charge her with? I mean,
I believe it's a fine and
And the state surcharge, $95 plus whatever the judge's discretion. I mean, I know with inspection stickers they can go lower, they can go higher, but usually they're not. I never heard of one being more than $200.
Right.
You know what I mean? So basically, between the state surcharge and the fine that the judge would put, it would be a $300 maximum type thing.
Right. Well, I mean, we all know it's a statutory excuse of extortion to, you know, fund this corrupt system. You know, and that's the reason why I'm trying to help my friend out here with this. You know, it's a case of, you know, standing up at the local level. You know, I'm as far as the local town politics and stuff. I try to attend the town board meetings to make sure that, you know, they don't impose some ridiculous regulation or what have you, you know, on the community here. But you know, it's an uphill battle as always.
So she was running the car with an expired sticker. Was there a reason she was running? I mean, did the car not pass inspection? Did she have some?
No, what it was is he had just purchased the car, mm-hmm. and the Department of Motor Vehicles, when he registered it with the state, never extended him the 10-day grace to get it inspected.
So then it wouldn't pass because it needed to be run in order to pass inspection. So hence she caught in a catch 22 situation.
He was actually at work. He didn't have time before work to get the inspection done, but he went like a few days later and got it done. So I mean the vehicle is now inspected, but you know it's still. You know, the issue is that the judge is refusing to even acknowledge that there's a jurisdictional issue at play here, which, I mean, because they have no jurisdiction to begin with, because all it is revenue gathering. You know, I mean,
listen, they create a mandatory program of inspection, and then they put obstacles in your way of complying with that. There's a lot of problems with the New York State inspection programs every day, and one of them is that they will not, many times they will not issue a temporary inspection sticker on something that hasn't been in their books or that hasn't been inspected in the past year, which is a violation of your free travel. I mean, they're getting ridiculous with this inspection baloney, and the whole system is just designed to make money, and it's really, I mean, I can prove that it's not even really, you know, they got this whole emissions thing, and it's a farce, basically.
Right, and it's a total violation of Fifth Amendment due process from beginning to end.
Yeah, so I don't know. I mean, look, you pick your battles. I don't know where you're going to go with that as far as where they'll be willing to go. You would think that even the judge or the prosecutor would have dropped it by now. I mean, the fact that they didn't issue a 10-day temporary to drive the car, you know, is kind of a extenuating circumstance that they helped create. If she got a ticket driving the car from the time that it was registered, you know, it was registered, she didn't get a 10-day temporary to drive it in order to have it facilitate being inspected. And so I would stick to that being the reason why the ticket was issued in the first place. It's because New York State was operating arbitrarily and capriciously, not issuing that, causing her in the need to drive the car because she needed her transportation for whatever reason, and they're denying her free travel. That's where I would go. Look, you created this system, and you put problems in it to trap people. It's entrapment, and it's arbitrary and capricious, and you know, it's just like what they do, you know, they create a problem, and then they're going to give you the solution to the problem. Yeah, pay the fine and go, you know, and go get inspected.
Right, but there's still no true remedy to the injury, and they're creating, the state itself is creating the injured party here, and claiming to be the injured party while doing so.
Yeah, and plus they didn't issue the temporary, so they created their own. Look, isn't there a premise in law that says that you can't have created the problem yourself? I mean, when you're trying to sue somebody, under Article 78 and that, it says that you cannot have created the problem yourself. It had to come from outside. So the state created their own problem. Not that they can even be an injured party, but they're acting as an injured party, and they're only injured because they created the problem to be injured by not issuing that temporary thing.
Right, but doesn't that create another issue though with the state saying that they are the injured party?
Absolutely.
And then trying to proceed over their own case?
They do it every day, even in criminal cases. They claim to be the injured party, and we know that they can't be. And that's
right.
That's a bigger fight for them to admit. And you're gonna end up in the Supreme Court with that or whatever. I mean, they're not gonna be willing to say that the state can't be the injured party because they'd have to let thousands and thousands of people
out
of jail.
But don't we already have Supreme Court cases that say that though?
They don't care. Look, what are they going on? That's what John went over earlier today. That they're operating outside the law. They don't care. You know, I mean, it's easier for them to take responsibility if you bring it down to the statutory level and say, look, you created this problem yourself. Never mind the fact that the state can't be the injured party, and I would mention that in the paperwork. But you're gonna have more trouble getting them to admit that they can't be the injured party. Look, every time a cop pulls somebody over and swears out a thing, who's the injured party? It's the cop isn't, if he's not swearing an affidavit and claiming that you put him in danger or something.
Right, he's creating the injured party of his own volition.
Right, I mean, he's not the injured party. He's just a statutory regulation, fee collector, so to speak.
Well, there's a local gentleman that used to be a local judge in the Saranac Lake area that called the state police here in New York nothing more than road pirates.
Yeah, well, it's the truth. So I don't know what to tell you. I mean, look, it's an issue. It depends on, you know, how far you want to go with it. I mean, you could.
I'm prepared to go all the way to Supreme Court with it. I mean, if we don't start at, you know, the grassroots, the local community level, then, you know, there's no point in fighting anywhere else, because we have to show the people locally that the power resides with them and not these hypocrites of office.
Well, I'll give you another little clue here, and I know it's getting, we're going to have to go soon, but that's okay. We need to finish this up. There has been recently, in the past 2, 3, 4 years, there's like 12 states, I think it's 12 is the proper number, somewhere around 12 or 14 states that rescinded their inspection law. And the reason that they were able to do that is because they were getting so many inspection sticker tickets. There must be a group of lawyers or people that are watching that when they get to a certain percentage of non-compliance, which is proven by the tickets that are written, they can bring a case into the court and say, look, the people have spoken. The non-compliance means that they've annulled this, and you need to cease and desist the law. And that happened in 14 states. So that's something, that's a good thing for you. That's another, I don't know, something that maybe you could use, because New York State is pretty high on the inspection thing. They're having problems, and I know that for a fact, because I do inspections. I'm a registered repair shop, so they're probably coming after me for giving you advice. But anyway, I know that when people were getting tickets, because around here there's not enough inspection stations, and they're saying they put a moratorium on inspection stations in Greene County and Albany County over here, and they said they're not going to issue any more inspection licenses. So if somebody comes in and they're a shop and they want to do inspections, they have to buy out the shop, the previously existing shop. So essentially what they did is they turned that inspection station license into a taxi cab medallion. And the last one I know that was sold, it went for something like $20,000. So they create a mandatory thing, and then they put a moratorium on issuing enough of them. The market's supposed to determine how many inspection stations, not the state. The state says we have enough. Well, what do you mean you have enough? They have enough because they don't want to hire any more guys to administer the inspection stations that are out there. So they don't want to spend any more money, so they put a moratorium on it. You know, look, if I want to put an inspection station across the street from another inspection station, nobody should tell me that I can't do that. It's supposed to be the free market. You know,
right.
Communism is the one that says we need 5 inspection stations and 3 McDonald's and this and that, because they're all omniscient. They know everything that we need. But that's not true. The market determines what we need, and the way that's determined is by your pocketbook. So they've created this need, putting a moratorium on these inspection stations, creating a greater hardship on people getting their stickers done. And so they got all kinds of problems in this program. But if you could get data on what was happening in the court was, if I sent in a piece of paper, they got the car inspected, and I sent it a couple times. I wrote, you know, one girl was here waiting for me, and I was busy, and so she went down the road to try to kill 2 birds with 1 stone and take care of an errand. And on the way back, she got caught. Meanwhile, she had the appointment and she was waiting for me, but she left, and then she came back and they gave her a ticket. So I wrote a little note that, you know, I was due to inspect it. And anyway, what I found out is anybody that comes in with a receipt that they got their car inspected, they completely dismiss the ticket and they dismiss the state surcharge, which is unheard of. That says to me that somebody on the top of the state got the order that if they get it inspected, throw the whole thing out, because they don't want a record of these tickets, because I think they're getting to the point that this program could be nullified if somebody brings it up and makes the issue. I mean, if you can get the data, look at it, it's public knowledge. You got to get somebody to do a FOIA request of how many tickets are being written every month and every year on this inspection sticker, and what you're going to find is that people are they're not complying because they're unable to comply. They've made it so difficult that you can't comply, especially with an older car. So right. That's where I would go. I'd go and I'd tack the whole program and get it thrown out. I mean, if 14 states have done it, you're already in good company. And the fact of the matter is they've created a problem. And they're telling you they're an injured party, and they created their own problem to become an injured party, even though they can't right. really be an injured party. But they got like antitrust stuff going on, and all this phony baloney stuff going on here, you know, running this boondoggle of a program, and people are having more and more troubles getting their cars inspected, you know, and they're not making any more inspection stations. And then, of course, you know, the emission standard thing is they've got it so strict that, you know, they're trying to get all cars off the road after 100,000 miles, and they flag it if it's got more than 20,000 in a year. That tells me that they're all set up in that inspection program to charge you carbon credits when you come in. Oh, your car's over 100,000 miles, so your carbon footprint's bigger than average, so your inspection this month will be this year will be $165. If Obama was in there, we'd be already in that program. Or if you drive more than 20,000 miles in a year, that's another benchmark that comes up on the machine when we're inspecting. So that tells me that they've already got in their minds, and they've prepared it in the program to make a surcharge, and anybody that does, that has a car that is over 100,000 or drives more than 20,000 miles a year, they set it up in the program. They can't deny it. You know, obviously they're planning something. So this whole program is set to get you out of your car and get people, you know, that's the whole New World Order thing. They don't want us to have free transportation. They want you to move
right,
to the city. They want you to use public transportation that they can control so they can control the people. And that's what this is about.
Yeah, that's all right in line with the eugenics program outlined in the UN Agenda 21. That's dead ringer for everything that I've read into that.
So anyway, I think we beat the subject to death. I don't know. I gave you the best I could on that. I mean, maybe I gave you
right.
more than
I could. So let me ask this one further question, just if you don't mind. So you wouldn't bother fighting the jurisdiction?
No, you can always look at jurisdiction. Like you said, they don't have it. I would go there too. You know what I mean?
Because the judges has basically refused to even acknowledge that, you know, we're questioning jurisdiction. And she keeps trying to derail the conversation when jurisdiction is questioned as though the question was never said. You know, and you know, I keep bringing up that jurisdiction needs to be established before proceedings can go forth, and she just ignores it
because she doesn't know how to do it, and she knows that they probably don't have it. So, you know, that would be
that was my thought.
Yeah, and I mean, or she's just completely ignorant. She can't go there. I'm sure. How long has this been going on? She's probably already made calls up. You know, they're probably telling her what to do. She's not
right.
operating on her own. I would think that you've already got the attention of people above her.
It's been going on. The arraignment was a week from today, and then there was another supposed hearing today, but there was never anything heard. I made a motion a request for a hearings motion, or a motions hearing rather. And she flat out denied that.
Yeah, so you don't get any due process either, right?
Right. That's the whole problem. That's been my point from the beginning of all this, is that, you know, that his Fifth Amendment rights are being, you know, violated because there is no due process of law in this case.
Well, you know what? It's better to keep it simple. There's a lot of problems with the program, so you got to pick what way you want to go with this, and I mean, look, if you can win a jurisdictional argument, that would be great, because that's another nail in her coffin. That's a big one, though, because they're not going to want to, you know, admit that they don't have jurisdiction. So that's a tough
one. I definitely won the right to assist and to practice law without a license argument. So, I mean, I shut that down real quick and even requested that the assisted DA be placed under arrest under U.S. Code 18-242.
You got that whole court buzzing. Like, yeah, be careful because they're going up looking for another way to trip you up. I'm telling you right now.
I'm sure they are. That's the reason why I'm kind of looking for some aid here to get the wording in the habeas court or the writ for habeas corpus. You know, because I want to get that submitted for this gentleman, and you know,
look at the problem with the habeas corpus is you have to ask permission for them a habeas corpus, and they're going to deny it. We set up a system that you request for a habeas corpus, and then we file it on your behalf from the perspective of the grand jury. So if you want to do it that way, that's one way to do it.
Absolutely,
let's check them off, John.
And the habeas corpus that we wrote up is really written from the perspective of we the people, the grand jury. So if you want to do that, you can get a hold of you can go and fill out a form and intake for a habeas corpus. I think we got 5 or 6 of them coming through the pike. I think I saw a bunch of them up online. I got to go look tomorrow. So we'll be filing. I think if we got 5 or 6 done, we're going to be filing them this week.
Look, he already made the motion that it should have been done in common law, and the judge agreed with you. Isn't that what you said? And then
it's the town court in Chattanooga, New York.
It's a town court.
Yes.
Well, you could, like I said, when we do a habeas corpus, we move it from there. It has to be presided over by a federal judge, habeas corpus. In the case of someone's unalienable rights being denied, which is generally due process.
Right. Okay. So we'll be looking for one more.
Okay.
I'll get that submitted this week.
Go follow it on our website and put it in. I think this is perfect because because of the track he's taken and the things that were said, and then they get a habeas corpus from the perspective of the grand jury. We the people are really going to go crazy.
That suits me just fine.
And we go a step further. If they don't obey the order, then we go through the process of indictments, and we focus in on the federal judge for that indictment.
Well, that
sounds perfect.
On a traffic court case, they're going to get indicted.
Well, if the federal let me ask you, the person that's being restrained, is that you? Are you being
a friend of mine that works with my sister.
Okay, but the restrainment, is it physically imprisonment or is it just restrained to the court?
It's just restrained to the court at this point.
Well, that's okay. You know, the other
no
thing
action
you
has
do,
been taken against me.
The other thing that could be done is a challenge of jurisdiction. I think you talked a little bit about that, and that's another way to go.
Well, the judge is ignoring it.
Well, you see, maybe the next step to do is what's called an amicus curiae from the grand jury first, and the amicus curiae files the paper for that process. Now, if they fail to follow through with that, then next step is to move for cause into our court, where we then make the ruling, an order, and a ruling and an order, and if it isn't complied to, then the indictment is focused in on that judge. And that's probably the way to go, because if the person was in prison, I'd say, yeah, do the habeas corpus. But since they're not in prison, I do the amicus curiae from the grand jury, which we do in the form of moving. We move the case into our case. It's a joinder. But before we move it, we write a paper on behalf of the individual, which is called an amicus curiae, into the court. And it's done in a show cause fashion where they have to respond or dismiss. And if they don't respond, then it's a default. If they do respond, well, they can't respond with anything good because they don't have jurisdiction. That's the challenge. So we'll just make a ruling on it in the order. And then if the obedience isn't taking place, then at that point we move it into, like I said, then it gets moved into the court for cause. And then at that point, and it just takes time. It's a period of time, you know, 30 days, 30 days, 30 days. And then it becomes a joinder. We do an order and potentially an indictment. I'm not sure where we're setting with the indictments on that, but I think if the indictment goes through, we'll be focused in on that judge.
Okay. Well, then I'll be in contact this week to help facilitate that for him.
I suggest do the joinder because that's more appropriate, I think. Because you want to go after that judge. We don't want to chase a federal judge unless there's, life and limb attached to it, and in a sense that someone's in jail.
Right. So. Okay. That sounds good.
Okay.
All right. Thank you, gentlemen, very much.
We've come to the end, I think, Gerard.
Yeah. It's also 12:18, so.
Yeah. All right.
Same time, same channel next week.
Yeah, thanks everybody for coming. Lord willing, we'll see next week.
Yep.
Let me find the button to stop recording first, I guess. Let's see, where is that? There it is.